I stood on the sidewalk outside the house with my mouth hanging open. The street lights were all out. Only the lights of the van showed the damage, and Thomas turned them off after only a moment. There was no disturbance on the street, no outcry, no police presence. Whatever had happened, something had taken steps to keep it from disturbing the neighbors. I don't know how long I stood there. I felt Mouse's presence at my side, then Thomas's on the other side of me. "Harry," he said as if repeating himself, "what is this place?" "It's Michael's house," I whispered. "His family's home." Thomas flinched. He looked back and forth and said, "Those things came here?" I nodded. I felt unsteady. I felt so damn tired. Whatever happened here, it was over. There was nothing I could do at this point except see who had been hurt. And I did not want to do that. So I stood there, staring at the house until Thomas finally said, "I'll keep watch out here. Circle the house, see if there's anything to be seen." "Okay," I whispered. I swallowed, and my stomach felt like I'd swallowed a pound of thumbtacks. I wanted nothing in the world so much as to run away. But instead, I dragged my tired ass over the damaged lawn and through the house's broken doorway. Mouse, walking on three legs, followed me. There were sprinkles of blood, already dried, on the inside of the doorway. I went on inside the house, through the entry hall, into the living room. Furniture lay strewn all over the place, discarded and broken and tumbled. The television lay on its side, warbling static on its screen. A low sound, all white noise and faint interference, filled the room. There was utter silence in the house otherwise. "Hello?" I called. No one answered. I went into the kitchen. There were school papers on the fridge, most of them written in exaggerated childish hands. There were crayon drawings up there, too. One of a smiling stick figure in a dress had a wavering line of letters underneath that read, "I love you, Mama." Oh, God. The thumbtacks in my belly became razor blades. If I'd hurt them, I didn't know what I would do. "Harry!" Thomas called from outside. "Harry! Come here!" His voice was tense, excited. I went out the kitchen door to the backyard and found Thomas climbing down from a treehouse only a little nicer than my apartment, built up in the branches of the old oak tree behind the carpenter's house. He had a still form draped over his shoulder. I drew out my amulet and called Wizard Light as Thomas laid the oldest son, Daniel, out on the grass in the backyard. He was breathing, but looked pale. He was wearing flannel pajama pants and a white t-shirt soaked with blood. There was a cut on his arm, not too deep, but very messy. He had bruises on his face, on one arm, and the knuckles on both of his hands were torn and ragged. Michael's son had been throwing punches. It hadn't done him any good, but he'd fought. "Coat," I said, terse. "He's cold." Thomas immediately took off my duster and draped it over the boy. I propped his feet up on my backpack. "Stay here," I told him. I went in the house, fetched a glass of water, and brought it out. I knelt down and tried to wake the boy up to get him to drink a little. He coughed a little, then drank and blinked open his eyes. He couldn't focus them. "Daniel," I said quietly. "Daniel, it's Harry Dresden."
Dresden?
He said. "Yeah. Your dad's friend, Harry."
"Harry?"
he said. Then his eyes flew open wide, and he struggled to sit up.
"Molly!"
"Easy, easy," I told him. "You're hurt. We don't know how bad yet. Lie still."
"Can't,"
he mumbled.
"They took her. We were... Is Mom okay? Are the little ones okay?"
I chewed on my lip. "I don't know. Do you know where they are?" He blinked several times, and then he said,
"Panic room."
I frowned. "What?"
"Second floor. Safe room. Dad built it. Just in case."
I traded a look with Thomas. "Where is it?"
Daniel waved a vague hand. "Mom had the little ones upstairs. Molly and me couldn't get to the stairs. They were there. We tried to lead them away."
"Who, Daniel? They who?"
"The movie monsters." Reaper. Hammerhand. He shuddered. Scarecrow. I snarled a furious curse.
Thomas, stay with him. Mouse, keep watch.
I stood up and stalked into the house, crossed to the stairs, and went up them. The upstairs hallway had a bunch of bedrooms off it, with the oldest children's rooms being at the opposite end of the hall from the master bedroom, the younger children being progressively closer to Mom and Dad. I looked inside each room. They were all empty, though the two nearest the head of the stairs had been torn up pretty well. Broken toys and shattered child-sized furniture lay everywhere. If I hadn't been looking for it, I wouldn't have noticed the extra space between the linen closet and the master bedroom. I checked the closet in the master bedroom and turned up nothing. Then I opened the door to the linen closet and found the shelves in complete disarray, sheets and towels and blankets strewn on the floor. I hunkered down and held up my mother's amulet, peering closely, and then found a section of the back wall of the closet just slightly misaligned with the corner it met. I reached out and touched that part of the wall, closed my eyes, extending my senses through my fingertips. I felt power there. It wasn't a ward, or at least it was unlike any ward I had ever encountered. It was more of a quiet hum of constant power, and was similar to the power I'd felt stirring around Michael on several occasions. The power of faith. There was a form of magic protecting that panel. Lashiel, I murmured quietly. You getting this? She did not appear, but her voice rolled through my thoughts. Yes, my host. Angelic work. I exhaled. Real angels? Aye. Raphael, or one of his lieutenants from the feel of it. Dangerous? There was an uncertain pause. It is possible. You are touched by more darkness than my own. But it is meant to conceal the room beyond, not to strike out at an intruder. I took a deep breath and said, Okay. Then I reached out and rapped hard on the panel 3 times. I thought I heard a motion, weight shifting on the floorboard. I knocked again. Charity? I called. It's Harry Dresden! This time the motion was definite. The panel clicked, then rolled smoothly to one side, and a double-barreled shotgun slid out, aimed right at my chin. I swallowed and looked down the barrel. Charity's cold blue eyes faced me from the other end of the gun. You might not be the real Dresden, she said.
Sure I am.
Prove it, she said. Her tone was quiet, balanced, deadly. Charity, there's no time for this. You want me to show you my driver's license? Bleed, she said instead. Which was a good point. Most of the things who could play doppelganger did not have human plumbing or human blood. It wasn't an infallible test by any means, but it was as solid as anything a non-wizard could use for verification. So I pulled out my penknife and cut my already mangled left hand just a little. I couldn't feel it in any case. I bled red and showed her. She stared at me for a long second, then eased the hammers on the shotgun back down, set the weapon aside, and wriggled out of the space beyond the panel. I saw a candle lit back there. The rest of the carpenter children, sans Molly, were inside. Alicia was sitting up, awake, her eyes worried. The rest were sacked out. Molly, she said, once she'd gained her feet. Daniel. I found him hiding in the treehouse, I said. He's hurt. She nodded once. How badly? Bruised up pretty good. Groggy. But I don't think he's in immediate danger. Mouse and a friend of mine are with him. Charity nodded again, features calm and remote, eyes cold and calculating. She had a great, cool-headed act going, but it wasn't perfect. Her hands were trembling badly, fingers clenching and unclenching arrhythmically. And Molly? I haven't found her yet, I said quietly. Daniel might know what happened to her. Were they Denarians? She asked. I shook my head. Definitely not. Is it possible that they may return? I shrugged. It isn't likely. But possible? Yes. She nodded once, and her voice had the quality of someone thinking aloud. Then, the next thing to do is to take the children to the church. We'll make sure Daniel is cared for. I'll try to send word to Michael, and then we'll find Molly. Charity, I said. Wait. Charity thrust the heel of her hand firmly into my chest and pushed my shoulders back against the opposite wall. Her voice was quiet and very precise. My children are vulnerable. I'm taking them to safety. Help me or stand aside. Then she turned from me and began bringing her children out. Alicia helped as much as she could, her studious features tired and worried. But the littlest ones were sleepy to the point of hibernation and remained limp as dish rags. I pitched in, picking up little Harry and Hope, carrying one on each hip. Charity's expression flashed briefly with both worry and thanks, and I saw her control slip. Tears formed in her eyes. She closed them again, jaw clenched, and when she looked up, she had regained her composure. "Thank you," she said. "Let's move," I replied, and we did. Tough lady. Very tough. We'd had our differences, but I had to respect the proud core of her. She was the kind of mother you read about in the paper, the kind who lifts a car off of one of her kids. It was entirely possible that I'd just killed her oldest daughter. If Charity knew that, if she knew that I'd put her children in danger, she'd murder me. If Molly had been hurt because of me, I'd help. St. Mary of the Angels is more than just a church. It's a monument. It's huge. Its dome rising to 17 stories and covered in every kind of accessory you could name, including angelic statues spread over the roof and ledges. You could get a lot of people arguing over exactly what it's a monument to, I suppose. But one cannot see the church without being impressed by its size, by its artistry, by its beauty. In a city of architectural mastery, St. Mary of the Angels need bow its head to no one. That said, the back of the place, the delivery doors, looked quite modestly functional. We went there, Charity driving her family's minivan, Thomas, me, and Mouse in Madrigal's battered rental van. Mouse and I got out. Thomas didn't. I frowned at him. "I'm going to find some place to park this," he said, "just in case Madrigal decides to report it as stolen or something." "Think he'll make trouble for us?" I asked. "Not face to face," Thomas said, his voice confident. "He's more jackal than wolf." "Look on the bright side," I said. "Maybe the scarecrow turned around and got him." Thomas sighed. "Keep dreaming. He's a greasy little rat, but he survives." He looked up at the church and then said, "I'll keep an eye on things from out here. Come on out when you're done." I got it. Thomas didn't want to enter holy ground. As a vampire of the White Court, he was as close to human as vampires got, and as far as I knew, holy objects had never inconvenienced him. So this wasn't about supernatural allergies. It was about his perceptions. Thomas didn't want to go into the church because he wasn't optimistic that the Almighty and his institutions would smile on him. Like me, he favored maintaining a low profile with regards to matters temporal. And if he had gone back to older patterns, doing what came naturally to his predator's nature, it might incline him to stay off the theological radar. Worse, entering such a place as the church might force him to face his choices, to question them, to be confronted with the fact that the road he'd chosen kept getting darker and further from the light. I knew how he felt. I hadn't been in a church since I'd smacked my hand down on Lashiel's ancient silver coin. Hell, I had a freaking fallen angel in my head, or at least a facsimile of one. If that wasn't a squirt of lemon juice in God's eye, I didn't know what was. But I had a job to do. "Be careful," I told him quietly. "Call Murphy. Tell her what's up." "You'd better get some rest soon, Harry," he replied. "You don't look good." "I never look good," I said. I offered him my fist. He rapped my knuckles gently with his own. I nodded and walked over to knock on the delivery doors while he drove off in Madrigal's van. I'd taken my duster back once Daniel had a blanket on him. Screw the heat. I wanted the protection. Its familiar weight on my shoulders and motion against my legs were reassuring. Fort Hill answered my knock, fully dressed, the white of his clerical collar easily seen in the night. His bright blue eyes looked around the parking lot once, and he hurried toward the van without a word being exchanged. I followed him. Fort Hill moved briskly, and we unloaded the van, Alicia shepherding the mobile kids indoors while he and Charity carried Daniel in between them. I followed with the two little wet dish rags, trying to keep my tired muscles from shaking too obviously. Fort Hill led us to the storage room that sometimes doubled as refugee housing. There were half a dozen folded cots against one wall, and another one already opened, set out, and occupied by a lump under a blanket. Fort Hill and Charity got the wounded Daniel onto a cot first, and then opened the rest of them. We deposited tired children on them. "What happened?" Fort Hill asked, his voice quiet and calm. I didn't want to hear Charity talk about it. "Got a cramp," I told him. "Need to walk it off. Come find me when Daniel gets coherent." "Very well," Charity said. Fort Hill looked back and forth between us, frowning. Mouse rose with a grunt of effort to limp after me. "No, boy. Stay and keep an eye on the kid." Mouse settled down again, almost gratefully. I beat it and started walking. It didn't matter where. There were too many things flying around in my head. I just walked. Motion wasn't a cure, but I was tired enough that it kept the thoughts, the emotions, from drowning me. I walked down hallways and through empty rooms. I wound up in the chapel proper. I've been in smaller stadiums. Gleaming hardwood floors shine over the whole of the chapel. Wooden pews stand in ranks, row upon row upon row, and the altar and nave are gorgeously decorated. It seats more than 1,000 people, including the balcony at the rear of the chapel, and every Sunday they still have to run 8 masses in 4 different languages to fit everyone in. More than size and artistry, though, there is something else about the place that makes it more than simply a building. There's a sense of quiet power there, deep and warm and reassuring. There's peace. I stood for a moment in the vast and empty room and closed my eyes. Right then, I needed all the peace I could get. I drifted through the room, idly admiring it, and wound up in the balcony, all the way at the top, in a dark corner. I leaned my head back against a wall. Lashiel's voice came to me very quietly and sounded odd, sad. "It is beautiful here." I didn't bother to agree. I didn't tell her to get lost. I leaned my head back against the rear wall and closed my eyes. I woke up when Fort Hill's steps drew near. I kept my eyes closed, half hoping that if I didn't seem to waken, he would go away. Instead, he settled a couple of feet down the pew from me and remained patiently quiet. The act wasn't working. I opened my eyes and looked at him. "What happened?" he asked quietly. I pressed my lips together and looked away. "It's all right," Fort Hill said quietly. "If you wish to tell me, I'll speak of it to no one." "Maybe I don't want to talk to you," I said. "Of course," he said, nodding. "But my offer stands, should you wish to talk. Sometimes the only way to carry a heavy burden is to share it with another. It is your choice to make." Choices. Sometimes I thought it would be nice not to make any choices. If I never had one, I could never screw it up. "There are things I don't care to share with a priest," I told him, but I was mostly thinking out loud. He nodded. He took off his collar and set it aside. He settled back into the pew, reached into his jacket, and drew out a slender silver flask. He opened it, took a sip, and offered it to me. "Then share it with your bartender." That drew a faint, snorting laugh from me. I shook my head, took the flask, and sipped. An excellent, smooth scotch. I sipped again, and I told him what happened at the convention and how it had spilled over onto the Carpenter household. He listened. We passed the flask back and forth. I finished by saying, "I sent those things right to her door." I never meant it to happen. Of course not, he said. It doesn't make me feel any better about it. Nor should it, he said. But you must know that you are a man of power. How so? Power, he said, waving a hand in an all-encompassing gesture. All power is the same. Magic, physical strength, economic strength, political strength, it all serves a single purpose. It gives its possessor a broader spectrum of choices. It creates alternative courses of action. I guess, I said, so? So, he said, you have more choices, which means that you have much improved odds of making mistakes. You're only human. Once in a while, you're going to screw the pooch. I don't mind that, I said, when I'm the only one who pays for it. But that isn't in your control, he said. You cannot see all outcomes. You couldn't have known that those creatures would go to the carpenter house. I ground my teeth. So? Daniel's still hurt. Molly could be dead. But their condition was not yours to ordain, Fort Hill said. All power has its limits. Then what's the point? I snarled, suddenly furious. My voice bounced around the chapel in rasping echoes. What good is it to have power enough to kill my friend's family, but not power enough to protect them? What the hell do you expect from me? I've got to make these stupid choices. What the hell am I supposed to do with them? Sometimes, he replied, his tone serious, you just have to have faith. I laughed, and it came out loud and bitter. Mocking echoes of it drifted through the vast chamber. Faith, I said. Faith in what? That things will unfold as they are meant to, Fort Hill said. That even in the face of an immediate ugliness, the greater picture will resolve into something all the more beautiful. Show me, I spat. Show me something beautiful about this. Show me the silver fucking lining. He pursed his lips and mused for a moment. Then he said, there's a quote from the founder of my order. There is something holy, something divine, hidden in the most ordinary situations, and it is up to each one of you to discover it. What's that supposed to mean? I asked. That the good that will come is not always obvious, nor easy to see, nor in the place we would expect to find it, nor what we personally desire. You should consider that the good being created by the events this night may have nothing to do with the defeat of supernatural evils or endangered lives. It may be something very quiet, very ordinary. I frowned at him. Like what? He finished off the little flask and rose. He put it away and put his collar back on. I'm afraid I'm not the one you should ask. He put a hand on my shoulder and nodded toward the altar. But I will say this. I've been on this earth a fair while, and one way or another, this too shall pass. I have seen worse things reverse themselves. There is yet hope for Molly, Harry. We must strive to do our utmost and to act with wisdom and compassion. But we must also have faith that the things beyond our control are not beyond his. I sat quietly for a minute, and I said, you almost make me believe. He arched an eyebrow. But I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if it's possible for me. The corners of his eyes wrinkled. Then perhaps you should try to have faith that you might one day have faith. His fingers squeezed and then released my shoulder. He turned to go. Padre, I said. He paused. You won't tell Charity. He turned his head and I could see sadness in his profile. No, you aren't the only one too afraid to believe. Sudden footsteps clattered into the chapel, and Alicia hurried in, accompanied by Mouse. The big gray dog sat down and stared up at the balcony. Alicia, panting, looked up. Father? Here, Fort Hill said. Come quick, she said. Mama said to tell you Daniel's awake. Chapter 31. We listened to Daniel's recounting of the attack. It was simple enough. He'd heard Molly moving around downstairs and had come down to talk to his sister. There had been a knock at the door. Molly had gone to answer it. There had been an exchange of words, and then Molly had screamed and slammed the door. "She came running into the living room," Daniel said. "And they broke down the door behind her and came in." He shivered. "They were going upstairs, and Molly said we had to distract them. So I grabbed the poker from the fireplace and just sort of jumped them." He shook his head. "I thought they were just costumes, you know, like really stupid burglars or something. But the Reaper grabbed me, and he was going to, you know, cut me with that carved knife." He gestured vaguely at his wounded arm. "Molly hit him, and he dropped me." "With what?" I asked him. He shook his head. His thin, awkward, adolescent features were hollow with pain, weariness, and a kind of lingering disbelief. His words were all slightly stiff, wooden, as if reporting events in an unappealing motion picture rather than actual experiences. "I couldn't see. I think she must have had a bat or something. He dropped me." "Then what?" I asked him. He swallowed. "I fell and bumped my head on the floor, and they grabbed her, the Reaper and the Scarecrow, and they carried her out the door. She was screaming." He bit his lip. "I tried to stop them, but Hammerhand chased me, so I ran out the back and up into the treehouse, 'cause I figured, you know, he doesn't have any hands, just hammers, so how's he gonna climb up after me?" He looked to Charity and said, shame in his voice, "I'm sorry, Mom. I wanted to stop them. They were just too big." Tears welled up in his eyes, and his thin chest heaved. Charity caught him in a fierce hug, squeezing him hard and whispering to him. Daniel broke down, sobbing. I got up and walked to the far side of the room. Fort Hill joined me there. "These creatures," I told him quietly, "inflict more than simple physical damage. They rip into the psyches of those they attack." "This happened to Daniel?" Fort Hill asked. "I'd have to take a closer look to be certain, but it's probable. Kid's gonna have it tough for a while," I said. "It's like emotional trauma, someone dying, that kind of thing. It tears people up in the same way. They don't get over it fast." "I've seen it too," Fort Hill said. "I haven't brought this up yet, but I thought you should know that Nelson came to me earlier this evening." I nodded at the cot that had been occupied when we came in. "That him?" "Yes." "How'd he strike you?" I asked. Fort Hill pursed his lips. "If I didn't know you sent him, I would have thought he was having a bad reaction to drugs. He was almost incoherent, very agitated, terrified in point of fact, though he would not or could not explain why. I managed to get him calmed down, and he all but fainted." I frowned, running the fingers of my right hand back through my hair. "Did you have the sense that anyone was following him?" "Not at all, though I might have missed something." He essayed a tired smile. "It's late, and I'm not as spry as I used to be after 10 o'clock or so." "Thank you for helping him," I said. "Of course. Who is he?" "Molly's boyfriend," I said. I glanced across the room at the mother holding her son. "Maybe Charity doesn't need to know that part either." He blinked and then sighed. "Oh, dear." "Yeah," I said. "May I ask you a question?" he asked.
"Sure."
"These creatures, these phages, if they are what you say, beings of the spirit world, then how did they manage to cross the house's threshold?"
"Traditional way," I said. "They got an invitation."
"From whom?"
"Probably Molly," I said.
He frowned. "I have difficulty believing that she would do such a thing." I felt my mouth tighten. "She probably didn't know they were monsters. They're shapeshifters. They probably appeared to her as someone she knew and would invite in."
Fort Hill said, "Ah, I see. Someone such as you, perhaps."
"Perhaps," I said quietly.
"Makes it the second time someone has used my face to get a shot at Michael's family.
Fort Hill said nothing for a moment. Then he said, It occurs to me that these creatures killed without compunction in your previous encounters. Why would they carry Molly away instead of simply murdering her?
I don't know yet, I said. I don't know how my spell managed to bring them to Molly. I don't know precisely what these things are or where they hail from, which means I can't figure out why they've been showing up or where they might have taken the girl.
I waved a hand in a frustrated gesture. It's driving me insane. I've got tons of facts, and none of them are lining up.
You're tired, Fort Hill said. Perhaps some rest.
I shook my head. No, Padre. The things that took her won't rest. The longer she's in their hands, the less likely it is we'll ever see her again.
I rubbed at my eyes. I need to rethink it.
Fort Hill nodded at me and rose. On the other side of the room, Charity was covering her exhausted son with a blanket. Even Alicia had surrendered to fatigue, and now only the adults were awake.
I'll leave you to it, then.
Have you eaten recently?
Sometime in the Mesozoic era, I said.
Sandwich?
My stomach made a gurgling noise. Only if you insist.
I'll see to it, Fort Hill said. Excuse me. He went over to Charity and took her arm, leading her out as he spoke quietly to her. Now that her children had been cared for, she looked like she might come apart at the seams. They left the room together, leaving me in the dimness with Mouse and a lot of sleeping kids.
I thought some more.
I picked up all the facts I knew, turning them every which way, trying to figure out something, anything, that would let me put a stop to this insanity.
The phages. The answer was in the phages.
Once I knew their identity, I could begin to work out who might be using them and what I might do to learn more about them. There had to be a commonality to them, somewhere, something that linked them together, some fact that could provide me a context in which to judge their motivations and intentions. But what the hell could they have in common, other than being monsters who fed on fear? They'd shown up randomly in a bathroom, a kitchen, a parking lot, a conference room. Their victims had been disparate, seemingly random. They had all appeared as figures from horror movies, but that fact seemed fairly unremarkable, relatively speaking. Try as I might, I could find nothing to join them together to let me recognize them. Frustrated, I rose and went over to Daniel's cot. I called up my sight. It took me longer than normal. I braced myself and regarded the boy. I'd been right. He'd taken a psychic flogging. The phage had been worrying at his mind, his spirit, even as it had threatened his flesh. I could see the wounds as long, bleeding tears in his flesh. Poor little guy. It would haunt him. I hoped he would be able to get a little rest before the nightmares woke him up. I stared at him for a good while, making sure his suffering was burned indelibly into my head. I wanted to remember for the rest of my life what the consequences of my screw-ups might be. I heard a sound to the side and glanced up without thinking, turning my sight upon the source of the sound, a restlessly stirring Nelson. If little Daniel had been the recipient of a savage beating, Nelson's spirit had been in the hands of hell itself. His entire upper body was disfigured under my sight, covered in hideous, festering boils and raw, bleeding burns. The damage was worst around his head and faded gradually as it descended his torso. And each of his temples bore tiny, neat holes, sharp and cauterized, as if by a laser scalpel. Just like Rosie. Chains of logic cascaded through my brain. My head swam. I shoved the sight away from me, and my ass fell straight down to the floor. I knew. I knew why my spell had sent the phages after the carpenters. I knew why Molly had been taken. I could make a good guess at where. I knew what the phages all had in common. I knew who had sent them. The realization terrified me with a fear so cold and sharp that it literally paralyzed me.
I could barely clap my hand over my mouth to keep from making whimpering sounds. It took me a while to force myself to calm down. By the time I did, Fort Hill had returned bearing sandwiches. He settled down on a cot, clearly exhausted, and went to sleep. I ate my sandwiches, then I went looking for Charity. I found her in the chapel, sitting up high in the balcony. She stared down at the altar and did not react when I came up the steps to her and settled down on the bench beside her. I sat with her in silence for a minute. "Charity," I whispered, "I need to ask you something." She sat in stony silence. Her chin moved a fraction of a degree up and down. "How long?" I murmured. "How long since what?" she asked. I took a deep breath. "How long has it been since you've used your magic?" Chapter 32. I couldn't have gotten more of a reaction if I'd shot her. Charity's face turned sheet white, the blood draining from it. She froze in place, grasping the edge of the wooden pew in front of her with both hands. Her knuckles turned white, and the wood creaked. She gnashed her teeth and bowed her head. I didn't push. I waited. She opened her eyes again, and she wasn't hard to read. Her thoughts and emotions were clear on her face. Panic, desperation, self-loathing. Her eyes flicked from one possibility to another. She considered denying it. She considered lying to me. She considered simply walking away. "Charity," I told her, "tell me the truth." Her breathing quickened. I saw her desperation growing. I reached out with one hand and turned her face toward me. "Your daughter needs you. If we don't help her, she's going to die." Charity flinched and pulled away from me. Her shoulders shook with a silent sob. She fought to control her breathing, her voice, and whispered, "A lifetime." I felt some tension ease in me. Her reaction confirmed that I was on the right track. "How did you know?" she asked. "Just putting lots of little things together," I said. "Please, Charity, tell me." Her voice was rough, half strangled, as though the breath that carried her words had been tainted with something rotten. "I had some talent. It showed just before my 16th birthday. You know how awkward that kind of thing can be?" "Yeah," I said. "How'd your family take it?" Her mouth twisted. "My parents were wealthy, respectable. When they had time to notice me, they expected me to be normal, respectable. They found it easier to believe that I was a drug addict, emotionally unbalanced." I winced. There were a lot of situations that could meet someone with a burgeoning magical talent. Charity's was one of the worst. "They sent me away to schools," she said, "and to hospitals disguised as schools." She waved a hand. "I eventually left them, just left them. I struck out on my own." "And fell in with a bad crowd," I said quietly. She gave me a bitter smile. "You've heard this story before." "It isn't uncommon," I said quietly. "Who was it?"
A coven of sorts, I suppose," she said. "More of a cult. There was a young man leading it, Gregor. He had power. He and the others, all young people, mixed in religion and mysticism and philosophy and, well, you've probably seen such things before."
I nodded. I had. A charismatic leader, dedicated followers, a collection of strays and homeless runaways. It rarely developed into something positive.
"I wasn't strongly gifted," she said. "Not like you. But I learned about some of what happens out there, about the White Council."
The bitter smile returned.
"Everyone was terrified of them. A warden visited us once. He delivered a warning to Gregor. He'd been toying about with some kind of summoning spells, and the wardens got wind of it. They interviewed each of us, evaluated us, told us the laws of magic, and told us never to break them if we wished to live."
I nodded and listened. She spoke more quickly now, the words coming out in a growing rush. They'd been pent up for a long time.
Gregor resented it. He grew distant. He began practicing magic that walked the crumbling edges of the Council's laws. He had us all doing it.
Her eyes grew cold. The others began disappearing, one by one. No one knew where they had gone. But I saw what was happening. I saw Gregor growing in power.
He was trading them, I said.
She nodded once. He saw my face when I realized it. I was the next one to go. He came to take me away, and I fought him, tried to kill him, wanted to kill him, but he beat me. I remember only parts of it, being chained to an iron post.
The dragon, I said.
She nodded. Some of the bitterness faded from her smile.
And Michael came, and he destroyed the monster and saved me.
She looked up at me. Tears filled her eyes and streaked down her cheeks, but she did not blink.
I swore to myself that I would leave that behind me, the magic, the power.
I had urges, she swallowed, to do things only a monster would do. When Cereothrax died, Gregor went mad, utterly mad. But I wanted to turn my power against him anyway. I couldn't think of anything else.
Hard to do, I said quietly. You were a kid, no real training, exposed to some nasty uses of power.
Yes, she said. Without Michael, I would never have been able to leave it behind me. He never knew. He still doesn't know. He remained near me in my life, making sure that I was all right, and he was such a good soul. When he smiled at me, it was like all the light in the world was shining out at me. I wanted to be worthy of that smile.
My husband saved my life, Mr. Dresden, and not only from the dragon. He saved me from myself.
She shook her head.
I never touched my power again after the night I met Michael.
We married soon after,
and in time, the power withered, and good riddance to it.
So, when Molly's talent began to manifest, I said quietly, you tried to get her to abandon it as well.
I was well aware of how dangerous it could be, she said, how innocent it could seem.
She shook her head.
I did not want her exposed to the things that had nearly destroyed my life.
But she did it anyway, I guessed. That's what really came between the two of you. That's why she ran away from home.
Charity's voice turned raw.
Yes. I couldn't get through to her how dangerous it was, what she might be sacrificing.
She made no effort to stem or hide her tears.
And you were there. A hero who fought beside her father, used his power to help people.
She let out a tired laugh.
For the love of God, you saved my life. We named our child for you. Once she realized she had the talent, nothing could keep her from it.
Christ. No wonder Charity hadn't much liked me. Not only was I dragging her husband off to who knew where to fight who knew what, I was also setting an example to Molly of everything Charity wanted her to avoid.
I didn't know, I told her.
She shook her head. Then she said,
I have been honest with you. No one else knows what you do now. Not Michael, not my daughter, no one.
She drew a Kleenex from her pocket and wiped at her eyes.
What has happened to my daughter?
I exhaled. What I've got right now is still mostly guesswork, I said, but my gut tells me it all fits together.
I understand, she said.
I nodded and told Charity about the attacks at the convention and about how Molly had gotten me involved.
I examined the victims of the first two attacks, I said quietly. One of them, a girl named Rosie, showed evidence of a kind of a psychic trauma. At the time, I attributed it to the phages attack on her.
Charity frowned.
It wasn't?
I shook my head. I found an identical trauma on Nelson. I took a deep breath and said, Molly is the link between them. They're both her friends. I think she was the one who hurt them. I think she used magic to invade their minds. Charity stared at me, her expression sickened.
What?
No, she shook her head. No, Molly wouldn't. Her face grew even more pale.
Oh, God.
She's broken one of the council's laws. She shook her head more violently.
No, no, no. She would not do such a thing.
I grimaced and said, I think I know what she did and why she did it. Tell me. I took a deep breath. Rosie is pregnant, and she showed physical evidence of drug addiction, but none of the psychological evidence of withdrawal. I think Molly took steps when she found out her friend was pregnant to force her away from the drugs. I think she did it to protect the baby. And then I think she did the same thing to Nelson. But something went wrong. I think what she did to him broke something. I shook my head. He got paranoid, erratic. Charity stared down at the altar below, shaking her head.
Is it the council, then, that took her?
No, I said. No. What she did to Rosie and Nelson left a kind of mark on her, a stain. I think she forced Rosie and Nelson to feel fear whenever they came near their drugs. Fear is a powerful motivator, and it's easy to exploit. She wanted them to be afraid of the drugs. She had good intentions, but she wanted her friends to be frightened.
I don't understand.
Whoever called up these phages, I said, needed a way to guide them from the never-never to the physical world. They needed a beacon, someone who would resonate with a sympathetic vibe. Someone who, like the phages, wanted to make people feel fear.
And they used my Molly, Charity whispered.
Then she stared at me for a moment.
You did it, she said quietly. You tried to turn the phages back upon their summoner. You sent them after my daughter.
I didn't know, I told her. My God, Charity, I swear to you that I didn't know. People were dead, and I didn't want anyone else to be hurt. The wooden pew creaked even more sharply in her grip.
Who did this thing?
She said, and her voice was deadly quiet. Who is responsible for the harm to my children? Who is the one who called the things that invaded my home? I don't think anyone called them, I told her quietly. I think they were sent. She looked up at me and her eyes narrowed.
Sent?
I nodded. I hadn't considered that possibility until I realized what all of the attacks had in common. Mirrors.
Mirrors?
Charity asked. I don't understand. That was the common element, I said. Mirrors. The bathroom. Rosie's makeup mirror in the conference room, plenty of reflective steel surfaces in a commercial kitchen, and Madrigal's rental van windshield was reflecting images very clearly. She shook her head. I still don't understand. There are plenty of things that can use mirrors as windows or doorways from the spirit world, I said. But there's only one thing that feeds on fear and uses mirrors as pathways back and forth from the never-never. It's called a fetch.
Fetch?
Charity tilted her head, her eyes vague, as though searching through old memories.
I've heard of them.
Aren't they creatures of fairy?
Yeah,
I said quietly. Specifically, they're creatures of deepest, darkest winter, I swallowed. Even more specifically, they're Queen Mab's elite spies and assassins, shapeshifters with a lot of power.
Mab,
she whispered.
The Mab?
I nodded slowly.
And they've taken my daughter, she said, carried her away to Fairy.
I nodded again. She'll be a rich resource for them, a magically talented young mortal, compatible energy, not enough experience to defend herself. They can feed on her and her magic for hours, maybe days. That's why they didn't just kill her and have done. Charity swallowed.
What can we do?
I'm not sure, I said. It would be nice to have your husband along, though. She bit her lip and sent what might have been a hateful look down at the altar.
He's out of reach. Messages have been left, but...
We're on our own, I said.
We must do something, she said.
Yeah, I agreed. The problem is that we don't know where to do it.
I thought you just said that they had taken her back to Ferry.
Yeah, I said. But just because I tell you Ayers Rock is in Australia doesn't mean you're going to be able to find the damn thing. Australia's big, and Ferry makes it look like Rhode Island. Charity clenched her jaw.
There must be something.
I'm working on it, I said.
What will...
She paused and cleared her throat. How long does she have?
Hard to say, I told her. Time can go by at different rates between here and there. A day here, but an hour there. Or vice versa.
She stared steadily at me. I looked away and said,
Not long. It depends on how long she holds out.
They'll get all the fear out of her that they can, and then... I shook my head. A day, at most. She shook her head.
No,
she said quietly.
I will not let that happen. There must be a way to take her back.
I can get to Ferry, I said. But you've got to understand something. We're talking about opening a path into deep winter. If I'm strong enough to open the way, and if I'm strong enough to hold it open while simultaneously running a rescue operation against at least one ancient fetch who ate my magic like candy earlier tonight, we're still talking about defying the will of Queen Mab. If she's there, there's not a damn thing I can do. I don't have enough power to challenge her in the heart of her domain. The whole damn White Council doesn't have enough power. On top of that, I'd have to know precisely where to cross over into Ferry, because I'd have only minutes to grab her and get out, and I have no idea where she is.
What are you saying? She asked quietly. That I can't do it, I told her.
It's suicide. Charity's back stiffened.
So you're willing to leave her there?
No, I said. But it means that I'm going to have to find help wherever I can get it. Maybe from people and things that you won't much like. I shook my head. And it's possible I'll get myself killed before I can even make the attempt. And even if I get her out, there could be a price.
I'll pay it, she said. Her voice was flat, strong, certain. For Molly, I'll pay it.
I nodded. I didn't say the next thought out loud. That even if we did get the girl back, there might not be much left of her mind. And she'd broken one of the laws of magic. She could wind up on the floor of some lonely warehouse, a black bag over her head, until Morgan's sword took it off her shoulders. Or maybe worse, she could already have been twisted by the power she'd used. Even if I could find Molly and bring her home, it might already be too late to save her. But I could burn that bridge when I came to it. First, I had to find her. The only way to do that was to learn where the fetches had carried her through to the Never Never. Geography in the Never Never isn't like geography in the normal world. The Never Never touches our world only at certain points of sympathetic energy. A portion of the Never Never that touched an empty and abandoned warehouse might not be anywhere near the area of the spirit world that touched the full and busy childcare center across the physical street from the warehouse. To make it worse, the connections between the mortal world and the Never Never changed slowly over time as the world changed. There could be 1,000 places in Chicago where the fetches might have dragged Molly back to their lair. I had to find the correct one, and I had to do it before dawn, before the rising sun scattered and dispersed the residual traces of her presence that would be my only trail. I had about 2 hours, tops, to get my aching body back to my apartment to bathe and prepare for a spell that would have been dangerous had I been rested and entirely whole. Tired, hurting, pressured, and worried as I was, I would probably kill myself on Little Chicago's trial run. But my only other option was walk away and leave the girl in the hands of creatures that made nightmares afraid of the dark. I'll need something of hers, I said, rising. Hair or fingernail clippings would be best. Charity said, I have a lock of her hair in her baby book.
Perfect, I said. I'll pick it up from your place. Where's the book? She rose. I'll show you. I hesitated. I don't know if that's wise. She's my daughter, Mr. Dresden, Charity said. I'm coming with you. I was too tired to argue, so I nodded and started down out of the balcony. My ankle twinged, and I wobbled and almost fell. Charity caught me. Chapter 33. This is Thomas, I told Charity, waving a hand at my brother, who had fallen into step beside me as I left the church. He's more dangerous than he looks. I have a black belt, Thomas explained. Charity arched an eyebrow, looked at Thomas for about a second, and said, You're the White Court vampire who took my husband to that strip bar. Thomas gave Charity a toothy smile and said, Hey, it's nice to be remembered, and to work with someone who has a clue. He hooked a thumb at me and added, sotto voce, For a change. Charity's regard didn't change. It wasn't icy, nor friendly, nor touched by emotion. It was simply a remote, steady gaze, the kind one reserves for large dogs who pass nearby. Cautious observation, unexcited and deliberate. I appreciate that you have fought beside my husband before, but I also want you to understand that what you are gives me reason to regard you with suspicion. Please do nothing to deepen that sentiment. I do not remain passive to threats. Thomas pursed his lips. I half expected anger to touch his gaze, but it didn't. He simply nodded and said, Understood, ma'am. Good, she said, and we reached her van. You ride in the rearmost seat. I started to protest, but Thomas put his hand on my shoulder and shook his head. Her ride, her rules, he murmured to me in passing. I can respect that, so can you. So we all got in and headed for the carpenter's house. How's Mouse? Thomas asked. Legs hurt, I said. Took one hell of a shot to do it, he noted. That's why I left him back there, I said. Could be he's pushing his luck. Besides, he can help Fort Hill keep an eye on the kids. Uh-huh, Thomas said. Am I the only one who's starting to think that maybe Mouse is something special? Always thought that, I said. I wonder if he's an actual breed. Charity glanced over her shoulder and said, He looks something like a Caucasian. Impossible, I said. He has rhythm, and he can dance. Charity shook her head and said, It's a dog bred by the Soviet Union in the Caucasus Mountains for use in secured military installations. It's one of the only breeds that grows so large, but they tend to be a great deal more aggressive than your dog. Oh, he's aggressive enough for anybody when he needs to be, I said. Thomas engaged Charity in a polite conversation about dogs and breeds, and I leaned my head against the window and promptly fell asleep. I woke up briefly when the van stopped. Charity and Thomas spoke, and I dozed as they loaded some things into the van. I didn't wake up again until Thomas touched my shoulder and said, We're at your apartment, Harry. Yeah, I mumbled. Okay. I blinked a couple of times and hopped out of the van. Thomas, I said, get in touch with Murphy for me and tell her I need her at my place, now. And here. I fumbled in my duster's pockets and found a white napkin and a marker. I wrote another number. Call this number. Tell them that I'm calling in my personal marker. Thomas took the paper and arched a brow. Can't you be any more specific? I don't have to be, I said. They'll know why I want them. This will just tell them that it's time for them to get together with me. Why me? Thomas asked. Because I don't have time, I said. So unless you want to play with dangerous magic divinations, call the damn number and stop making me waste time explaining myself. Heil Harry, Thomas said, his tone a bit sullen, but I knew he'd do it. Hare? I asked Charity. She passed me an unmarked white envelope, her expression a mask. Thank you. I took it and headed for my apartment, the two of them following after me. I'll be working downstairs. The two of you should stay in the living room. Please be as quiet as you can and don't walk around too much. Why? Charity asked. I shook my head tiredly and waved a hand. No questions right now. I'll need everything I've got to find where they took Molly. And I'm already rushing this thing. Let me concentrate. I'll explain it later. If I survive it, I thought. I felt Charity's eyes on me, and I glanced back at her. She gave her head a brief, stiff nod. I took down the wards, and we went inside. Mister came over and rammed his shoulder against my legs, then wound his way around between Thomas's legs, accepting a few token pats from my half-brother. Then he surprised me by giving Charity the same treatment. I shook my head. Cats. No accounting for taste. Charity looked around my apartment, frowning, and said, "It's very well kept up. I had expected more debris." "He cheats," Thomas said, and headed for the refrigerator. I ignored them. There wasn't time for the full ritual cleansing and meditation, but my day had exposed me to all kinds of stains, external and otherwise, and I considered the shower to be the most indispensable portion of the preparation. So I went into my room, stripped, lit a candle, and got into the shower. Cool water sluiced over me. I scrubbed my skin until it was pink and washed my hair until my scalp got sore. The whole while, I sought out a quiet place in my mind, somewhere sheltered from pain and guilt, from fear and anger. I pushed out every sensation but for the bathing, and without conscious effort, my motions took on the steady rhythm of ritual. Something commonplace transformed into an act of art and meditation, like a Japanese tea ceremony. I longed for my bed. I longed for sleep, warmth, laughter. I pinned down those longings one at a time and crucified them, suspending them until such time as my world was a place that could afford such desires. One last emotion was too big for me, though. Try though I might, I could not keep fear from finding a way to slither into my thoughts. Little Chicago's maiden run was an enormous unknown quantity. If I'd done it all right, I would have myself one hell of a tool for keeping track of things in my town. If I'd made even a tiny mistake, Molly was dead, or worse than dead, and I'd get to find out what the light at the end of the long tunnel really was. I couldn't escape the fear. It was built into the situation. So instead, I tried to make my peace with it. Fear, properly handled, could be turned into something useful. So I made a small, neat place for its use in my head, a kind of psychic litter box, and hoped that the fear wouldn't start jumping around at the worst possible moment. I got out of the shower, dried, and slipped into my white robe again. I kept my thoughts focused, picked up my backpack and the white envelope, and went down to the basement lab. I shut the door behind me. If little Chicago went Nova, preventative spells I'd laid to keep energies from escaping the lab should mitigate the damage significantly. It wasn't a perfect plan by any means, but I'm only human. Which was a disturbing thought as I stared at the model on the table. Even a tiny mistake. Only human. I set the envelope at the edge of the table, my backpack on a shelf, and went around the basement lighting candles with a match. A spell would have been faster and neater, but I wanted to save every drop of power for managing the divination. So I made lighting each candle a ritual of its own, focusing on my movements, on precision, on nothing but the immediate interplay of heat and cold, light and darkness, fire and shadow. I lit the last candle and turned to the model city. The building shone silver in the candlelight, and the air quivered with the power I'd built into the model. Some tiny voice of common sense in my head told me that this was a horribly bad idea. It told me that I was making decisions because I was in pain and exhausted, and that it would be far wiser to get some sleep and attempt a spell when I stood a reasonable chance of pulling it off. I crucified that little voice, too. There was no room for doubts. Then I turned to the table and to the elongated circle of silver I'd built into its surface. Lashiel appeared between me and the table in her usual white tunic, her red hair pulled back into a tight braid. She held up both hands and said quietly, "I cannot permit you to do this." "You," I said in a quiet, distant voice.
are almost as annoying as a sudden phone call.
This is pointless, she said. My host, I beg you to reconsider.
I don't have time for you, I said. I have a job to do.
A job? She asked. Evading your responsibilities, you mean?
I tilted my head slightly. In my current mental state, the emotions I felt seemed infinitely far away and all but inconsequential.
How so?
Look at yourself, she replied, her voice that low, quiet, reasonable tone one uses around madmen and ugly drunks. Listen to yourself. You're tired. You're injured. You're racked by guilt. You're frightened. You will destroy yourself.
And you with me? I asked her.
Correct, she said. I do not fear the end of my existence, my host, but I would not be extinguished by one too self-deluded to understand what he was about.
I'm not deluded, I said.
But you are. You know that this effort shall probably kill you. And once it has done so, you will be free from any onus of what happened to the girl. After all, you heroically died in the effort to find her and retrieve her. You won't have to attend her funeral. You won't have to explain yourself to Michael. You won't have to tell her parents that their daughter is dead because of your incompetence. I did not reply. The emotions grew a little closer.
This isn't anything more than an elaborate form of suicide chosen during a moment of weakness, Lashiel said. I do not wish to see you destroy yourself, my host.
I stared at her. I thought about it. She might be right. It didn't matter.
Move, I murmured, before I move you.
Then I paused and said, wait a minute, what am I thinking? It isn't as though you can stop me. Then I simply stepped through Lashiel's image to the table and reached for the white envelope. The white envelope began to spin in place on the table and abruptly became dozens of envelopes, each identical, each whirling like a pinwheel.
But I can, Lashiel said quietly.
I looked up to find her standing on the opposite side of the table from me.
I witnessed the birth of time itself. I watched the mortal coil spring forth from perfect darkness. I watched the stars form, watched this world coalesce, watched as life was breathed into it and as your kind rose to rule it.
She put both hands on the table and leaned toward me, her blue eyes cold and hard.
Thus far, I have behaved as a guest ought. But do not mistake propriety for weakness, mortal. I beg you not to oblige me to take further action.
I narrowed my eyes and reached for my sight. Before I could use it, my left hand exploded into flame.
Pain, pain, pain. Fire, scorching, parboiling my hand as I tried to hold it back with my shield bracelet. The memory of my injury in that vampire-haunted basement came rushing back to me in THX, and my nerve endings were listening. I fought down a scream, breathing, my teeth snapping together so suddenly and sharply that a fleck of one of my molars chipped away.
It was an illusion, I told myself. A memory. It's a ghost, nothing more. It cannot harm you if you do not allow it to do so. I pushed hard against that memory, turning the focus of my will against it. I felt the illusion memory wobble. And then the pain was gone, the fire out. My body pumped endorphins into my bloodstream a heartbeat later, and I drifted on them as my focus started to collapse. I leaned hard against the table, my left hand held close to my chest in pure reflex, my right supporting my weight. I turned my attention to the envelopes and forced my will against them until the illusion grew translucent. I picked up the real envelope. Lashiel regarded me steadily, her beautiful face unyielding, determined.
Sooner or later, I'll push through anything you throw, I panted. You know that.
Yes, she said, but you will not be able to focus on the divination until you are quit of me. I may force you to exhaust yourself resisting me,
in which case you will not attempt the divination. Even if I only delay you until dawn, there will be no need for you to attempt it. She lifted her chin. Whatever happens, the divination will not be successful. I let out a low chuckle, which made Lashiel frown at me.
You missed it, I said.
Missed what?
The loophole. I could kill myself trying it while you rock the boat. And after all, this entire exercise is nothing more than a suicide attempt in any case. Why not go through with it?
Her jaw clenched. You would murder yourself rather than yield to reason?
More manslaughter than murder, I'd say.
You're mad, the fallen angel said.
Give me some Alka-Seltzer and I'll foam at the mouth, too.
This time, I hit Lashiel with the hard look. There's a child out there who needs me. I'd rather die than let her down. I'm doing the spell, period, so fuck off. She shook her head in frustration and looked away, frowning.
You are quite likely to die.
Broken record much? I asked.
I got out the lock of baby-fine hair, set my knife down on the table, and lit the ceremonial candles there. The fallen angel was correct, damn it. The fear stirred dangerously inside me, and my fingers shook hard enough to break the first kitchen match instead of kindling it to life.
If you must do this, Lashiel said, at least attempt to survive it. Let me help you.
You can help me by shutting the hell up and going away, I told her. Hellfire isn't going to be any use to me here.
Perhaps not, Lashiel said, but there is another way. There was a shimmer of light in the corner of my eye, and I turned to see a slowly pulsing silver glow upon the floor in the middle of my summoning circle. 2 feet beneath it lay the blackened denarius, where the rest of Lashiel was imprisoned.
Take up the coin, she urged me. I can at least protect you from a backlash. I beg you not to throw your life away.
I bit my lip. I didn't want to die, damn it. And the thought of failing to save Molly was almost worse than death. The holder of one of the 30 ancient silver coins had access to tremendous power. With that kind of boost, I could probably pull the spell off. And even if it went south, I could survive it under Lashiel's protection. Somehow, I knew that if I chose to do it, I could get the coin out from under the concrete in only a moment, too. I stared at the silver glow for a moment. Then I rolled my eyes and said, Are you still here? Lashiel's face smoothed into an emotionless mask, but there was a subtle, ugly tone of threat in her voice. You are much easier to talk to when you are asleep, my host. And she was gone. Fear rattled around inside me. I tried to calm it, but I couldn't regain my earlier detachment. Not until I thought of young Daniel, mangled beneath my wizard's sight, wounded, defending his family from something I had sent after them. I thought of Molly's brothers and sisters. I thought of her mother, her father. I thought of the laughter, the sheer, joyous, rowdy life of Michael's family. Then I pinked my fingertip with my ritual knife, touched the lock of baby hair to it, and laid it down within Little Chicago. I used a second drop of blood and an effort of will to touch the circle on the tabletop, closing it up and beginning the spell. I closed my eyes, focusing, murmuring a stream of faux Latin as I reached out to the model and brought it to life. My senses blurred, and suddenly I was standing on the tabletop at the model of my own boarding house. I thought the silver-colored model had grown to life size at first, then realized that the inverse was more accurate. I had shrunk to scale with Little Chicago, my awareness now within the spell, rather than in my own body, which stood over the table like Godzilla, murmuring the words of the spell. I closed my eyes and thought of Molly. My blood touched upon her lock of hair, and to my utter surprise, I shot off down the street with no more effort than it took to pedal a bicycle. The streets beneath me and the buildings around me glowed with white energy, the whole of the place humming like high-powered tension lines. Stars and stones, Little Chicago worked. It worked well. A surge of jubilation went through me, and my speed increased in proportion. I flashed through the streets, seeing faint images of people, like ghosts, the unsteady reflections of those now moving through the real Chicago around me. But then the spell wavered, and I found myself moving in a circle, like a baffled hound trying to pick up a scent trail. It didn't work. I made an effort and stood back in my own body, staring down at little Chicago, badly fatigued. Exhausted, I reached for my backpack, sat down, and fumbled Bob into my lap. His eyes lit up at once, and he said,
"Don't get me wrong, big guy, I like you, but not that way."
"Shut up," I growled at him. "Just tried to use little Chicago to find Molly's trail. It fizzled." Bob blinked.
"It worked? The model actually worked? It didn't explode?"
"Obviously," I said. "It worked fine. But I used a simple tracking spell, and it couldn't pick up her trail. So what's wrong with the damn thing?"
"Put me on the table," Bob said.
I reached up and did so. He was quiet for a minute before he said,
"It's fine, Harry. I mean, it's working just fine."
"Like hell," I growled. "I've done that tracking spell hundreds of times. It must be the model."
"I'm telling you, it's perfect," Bob said. "I'm looking at the darn thing. If it wasn't your spell, and it wasn't the model... Hey, what did you use to focus the tracking spell?"
"Lock of her hair."
"That's baby hair, Harry."
"So?" Bob let out a disgusted sound.
"So it won't work, Harry. Babies are like one big, enormous blank slate. Molly has changed quite a bit since that lock was taken. She doesn't have much to do with the person it got snipped from. Naturally, the spell couldn't track her."
"Damn it," I snarled. I hadn't thought of that, but it made sense. I had never used a lock of baby hair in the spell before, except once, to find a baby. Damn it, damn it, damn it. A tiny mistake. I was only human, and I had failed Molly. Chapter 34. I turned away from the table and hauled myself laboriously up the ladder to my living room. Charity sat on the edge of the couch with her head bowed, her lips moving. As I emerged, she stood up and faced me, tension quivering through her. Thomas, who had a kettle on my little wood-burning stove, glanced over his shoulder. I shook my head at them. Charity's face went white, and she slowly sat down again. I went to the kitchen, found my bottle of aspirin, and chewed up three of them, grimacing at the taste. Then I drank a glass of water. "You make those calls?" I asked Thomas. "Yeah," he said. "In fact, Murphy should be here in a minute." I nodded at him and walked over to settle into one of the easy chairs by the fireplace with my glass of water and told Charity, "I thought I could find her. I'm sorry. I shook my head and trailed off into silence. "Thank you for trying, Mr. Dresden," she said quietly. She didn't look up. "It was the baby hair," I said to Charity. "It didn't work. Hair was too old. I couldn't." I sighed. "I'm just too tired to think straight. Maybe," I said. "I'm sorry." Charity looked up at me. I expected fear, anger, maybe a little bit of contempt in her features. But none of that was there. It was instead something that I'd seen in Michael when the situation was really, really bad. It was a kind of quiet calm, a surety, totally at odds with the situation, and I could not fathom its source or substance. "We will find her," she told me quietly. "We'll bring her home." Her voice held the solid confidence of someone stating a fact as simple and obvious as 2 + 2 = 4. I didn't quite break out into a bitter laugh. I was too tired to do that. But I shook my head and stared at the empty fireplace. "Mr. Dresden," she said quietly, "I don't pretend to know as much about magic as you do. I'm quite certain you have a great deal of power." "Just not enough," I said. "Not enough to do any good." In the corner of my eye, I saw Charity actually smile.
It's difficult for you to realize that you are, at times, as helpless as the rest of us. She was probably right, but I didn't say as much out loud. I made a mistake, and Molly might be hurt because of it. I don't know how to live with that. You're only human, she said, and there was a trace of pensive reflection in her voice. For all your power. That answer isn't good enough, I said quietly. I glanced at her to find her watching me, her dark eyes intent. Not good enough for Molly. Have you done all that you can to help her? Charity asked me. I racked my brain for a useless moment and said, Yeah. She spread her hands. Then I can hardly ask you for more. I blinked at her. What? She smiled again. Yes. It surprises me to hear myself say it as well. I have not been tolerant of you. I have not been pleasant to you. I waved a tired hand. Yeah, but I get why not. I realize that now, she said. You saw. But it took all of this to make me see it. See what? That much of the anger I've directed at you was not rightfully yours. I was afraid. I let my fear become something that controlled me, that made me harm others. You. She bowed her head. And I let it worsen matters with Molly. I feared for her safety so much that I went to war with her. I drove her toward what I most wished her to avoid, all because of my fear. I have been afraid, and I am ashamed. Everyone gets scared sometimes, I said. But I allowed it to rule me. I should have been stronger than that, Mr. Dresden, wiser than that. We all should be. God did not give us a spirit of fear, but of love, of power, and of self-control. I absorbed that for a moment. Then I asked, Are you apologizing to me? She arched an eyebrow and then said, her tone wry, I am not yet that wise. That actually did pull a quiet laugh from me. Mr. Dresden, she said, we've done all we can do. Now, we pray. We have faith. Faith? I asked. She regarded me with calm, confident eyes. That a hand mightier than yours or mine will shield my daughter. That we will be shown a way. That he will not leave his faithful when they are in need. I'm not all that faithful, I said. She smiled again, tired but unwavering. I have enough for both of us. She met my eyes steadily and said, There are other powers than your magic, or that of the dark spirits that oppose us. We are not alone in this fight, Mr. Dresden. We need not be afraid. I averted my eyes before a soul gaze could get going, and before she could see them tear up. Charity, regardless of how she treated me in the past, had been there when the chips were down. She'd cared for me when I'd been injured. She'd supported me when she didn't have to do so. As abrasive, accusatory, and harsh as she could be, I had never for an instant doubted her love for her husband, for her children, or the sincerity of her faith. I never liked her too much, but I'd always respected her. Now, more than ever. I just hoped she was right when she said we weren't in this alone. I wasn't sure I really believed that, deep down. Don't get me wrong. I've got nothing against God, except for maybe wishing he was a little less ambiguous and had better taste in hired help. People like Michael and Charity, and to a lesser extent Murphy, had made me take some kind of faith under consideration now and again. But I wasn't the sort of guy who did well when it came to matters of belief, and I wasn't the sort of guy who I thought God would really want hanging around his house or his people. Hell, there was a fallen angel in my brain. I counted myself lucky that I hadn't met Michael or one of the other knights from the business end of one of the swords. I looked at the gift popcorn tin in the corner by the door where my staff and rod were settled, along with my practice fighting staff, an uncarved double of my wizardly tool, my sword cane, an umbrella, and the wooden cane sheath of Philocius. One of the three swords borne by Michael and his brothers in arms. The sword's last wielder had told me that I was to keep it and pass it on to the next knight. He said I would know who and when. And then the sword sat in my popcorn tin for years. When my house had been invaded by bad guys, they'd overlooked it. Thomas, who had lived with me for almost 2 years, had never touched it or commented on it. I wasn't sure that he'd ever noticed it, either. He just sat there, waiting. I glanced at the sword, and then up at the roof. If God wanted to throw a little help our way, now would be a good time to get that foreordained knowledge of who to give the sword to, at least. Not that it would do us all that much good, I supposed. With or without Fidelacius, we had a fair amount of power of the ass-kicking variety. What we needed was knowledge. Without knowledge, all the ass-kicking in the world wouldn't help. I watched the sword for a minute, just in case. No light show, no sound effects, not even a burst of vague intuition. I guess that wasn't the kind of help Heaven was dishing out at the moment. I settled back in my chair. Charity had returned to her quiet prayers. I tried to think thoughts that wouldn't clash, and hope that God wouldn't hold it against Molly that I was on her side. I glanced back over my shoulder. Thomas had listened to the whole thing with an almost supernatural quality of non-involvement. He was watching Charity with troubled eyes. He traded a glance with me that seemed to mirror most of what I was feeling. Then he brought everyone a cup of tea and faded immediately back to the kitchen alcove again while Charity prayed. Maybe 10 minutes later, Murphy knocked at the door and then opened it. Besides Thomas, she was the only person I'd entrusted with an amulet that would let her through my wards without harm. She wore one of her usual work outfits, black jacket, white shirt, dark pants, comfortable shoes. Gray pre-dawn light backlit her. She took a look around the place, frowning, before she shut the door. What's happened? I brought her up to speed, finishing with my failure to locate the girl's trail. So you're trying to find Molly? Murphy asked. With a spell? Yeah, I said. I thought that was pretty routine for you, Murphy said. I mean, I can think of 4 or 5 times at least you've done that. I shook my head. That's tracking down where something is. I'm looking for where Molly's been. It's a different bag of snakes. Why? Murphy asked. Why not go straight to her? Because the fetches have taken her back home with them, I said. She's in the Never Never. I can't zero in on her there. The best I can do is try to find where they crossed over, follow them across, and use a regular tracking spell once I'm through. Oh, she frowned and walked over to me. And for that you need her hair? Yeah, I said. Which we don't have, so we're stuck. She chewed on her lip. Couldn't you use something else? Nail clippings, I said. Or blood, if it was fresh enough. Uh-huh, Murphy said. She nodded at Charity. What about her blood? What? I said. She's the girl's mother, Murphy said. Blood of her blood. Wouldn't that work? No, I said. Oh, Murphy said. Why not? Because, I frowned. I looked up at Charity for a moment. Actually, there was a magical connection between parents and children. A strong one. My mother had worked a spell linked to Thomas and me that would confirm to us that we were brothers. The connection had been established, even though she had been the only common parent between us. The blood connection was the deepest known to magic. It might work, I said quietly. I thought about it some more and breathed. Stars and stones, not just work. Actually, for this spell, it might work better. Charity said nothing, but her eyes glowed with that steady, unmovable strength. I thought to myself, that's what faith looks like. I nodded my head to her in a bow of acknowledgement. Then I turned to Murphy and gave her a jubilant kiss on the mouth. Murphy blinked in total surprise. Yes, I whooped, laughing. Murph, you rock. Go Team Dresden. Hey, I'm the one who rocks, she said. Go Team Murphy. Thomas snorted. Even Charity had a small smile, though her eyes were closed and her head was bowed again, murmuring thanks, presumably, to the Almighty.
Murphy had asked me the exact question I'd needed to hear to tip me off to the answer. Help from above? I was not above taking help from on high. And given whose child was in danger, it was entirely possible that divine intervention was precisely what had happened. I touched the brim of my mental hat and nodded my gratitude vaguely heavenward, and then turned to hurry back to the lab. Charity, I presume you're willing to donate for the cause?
Of course, she said.
Then we're in business. Get ready to move, people. This will only take me a minute. I stopped and put a hand on Charity's shoulder. And then we're going to get your daughter back.
Yes, she murmured, looking up at me with fire in her eyes. Yes, we are.
This time, the spell worked. I should have known where the fetches had found the swiftest passage from their realm to Chicago. It was one of those things that, in retrospect, was obvious. Charity's minivan pulled into the little parking lot behind Clark Bell's run-down old movie theater. It was out of view of the street. The sun had risen on our way there, though heavy cloud cover and grumbling thunder promised unusually bad weather for so early in the day. That shouldn't have surprised me either. When the Queens of Fairy were moving around backstage, the weather quite often seemed to reflect their presence. Murphy pulled her car in right behind the minivan and parked beside it. All right, Murph, Thomas, I said, getting out of the van. Fairy fighting, 101.
I know, Harry, Thomas said.
Yeah, but I'm going to go over it anyway, so listen up. We're heading into the Never Never. We've got some wicked fairies to handle, which means we have to be prepared for illusions. I rummaged in my backpack and came out with a small jar. This is an ointment that should let you see through most of their bullshit. I went to Thomas and slapped some on him, then did Murphy's eyes, and then did my own. The ointment was my own mixture, based on the one the gatekeeper used. Mine smelled better, but stained the skin it touched with a heavy brown-black tone. I started to put the jar away. Charity calmly took the jar from my hands, opened it, and put ointment on her own eyes. What are you doing? I asked her.
I'm preparing to take back my daughter, she said.
You aren't going with us, I told her.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not. Charity, this is seriously dangerous. We can't afford to babysit you. Charity put the lid back on the jar and dropped it into my backpack. Then she opened the sliding door on the minivan and drew out a pair of heavy-duty plastic storage bins. She opened the first and calmly peeled out of her pullover jersey. I noted a couple of things. First, that Charity had won some kind of chromosomal lottery when it came to the body department. She wore a sports bra beneath the sweater, and she looked like she could have modeled it if she cared to do so. Molly had definitely gotten her looks from her mother. The second thing I noticed was Charity's arms. She had broad shoulders for a woman, but her arms were heavy with muscle and tone. Her forearms especially looked lean and hard, muscles easily seen shifting beneath tight skin. I traded a glance with Murphy, who looked impressed. I just watched Charity for a minute, frowning. Charity took an arming jacket from the first tub. It wasn't some beat-up old relic, either. It was a neat, quilted garment, heavy black cotton over the quilting, which was backed by what looked a lot like Kevlar ballistic fabric. She pulled it on, belted it into place, and then withdrew an honest-to-God coat of mail from the tub. She slipped into it and fastened half a dozen clasps with the swift assurance of long practice. A heavy sword belt came next, securing the mail coat. Then she pulled on a tight-fitting cap made in the same manner as the jacket, tucking her braided hair up into it, and then slipped a ridged steel helmet onto her head. She opened the second tub and drew out a straight sword with a cruciform hilt. The weapon was only slightly more slender and shorter than Michael's blessed blade, but after she inspected the blade for notches or rust, she flicked it around a few times as lightly as she would a rolled-up newspaper, then slid the weapon into the sheath on the sword belt. She tucked a pair of heavy chain gloves through the belt. Finally, she took a hammer from the big tub. It had a steel-bound handle about 4 feet long and mounted a head almost as large as a sledgehammer's, backed by a wicked-looking spike. She put the hammer over her shoulder, balancing its weight with one arm, and turned to me. She looked ferocious, so armed and armored, and the heavy black stain around her eyes didn't do anything to soften the image. Ferocious? Hell. She looked competent. And dangerous. Everyone just stared at her. She arched a golden eyebrow. "I make all of my husband's armor," she said calmly, "as well as his spare weaponry, by hand." "Huh," I said. No wonder she was buff. "You know how to fight, too?" She looked at me as though I was a dim-witted child. "My husband didn't become a master swordsman by osmosis. He works hard at it. Who did you suppose he's practiced against for the last 20 years? Her eyes smoldered again, a direct challenge to me. "These creatures have taken my Molly, and I will not remain here while she is in danger." "Ma'am," Murphy said quietly, "practice is very different from the real thing." Charity nodded. "This won't be my first fight." Murphy frowned for a moment, and then turned a troubled glance to me. I glanced at Thomas, who was facing away, a little apart from the rest of us, staying out of the decision-making process. Charity stood there with that war hammer over one shoulder, her weight planted, her eyes determined. "Hell's bells," I sighed. "Okay, John Henry, you're on the team." I waved a hand and went back to the briefing. "Fairies hate and fear the touch of iron, and that includes steel. It burns them and neutralizes their magic." "There are extra weapons in the tub, as well as additional coats of mail," Charity offered. "Though they might not fit you terribly well, Lieutenant Murphy." Charity had thought ahead. I was glad one of us had. "Mail coat is just a thing for discouraging nasty fairy beasties with claws." Murphy looked skeptical. "I don't want to break up the Battle of Hastings dress theme, Harry, but I find guns generally more useful than swords. Are you serious about this?" "You might not be able to rely on your guns," I told her. "Reality doesn't work the same way in the Never-Never, and it doesn't always warn you when it's changing the rules. It's common to find areas of fairy where gunpowder is non-combustible." "You're kidding," she said. "Nope. Get some steel on you. There's not a thing the fairies can do about that. It's the biggest edge mortals have on them." "The only edge," Charity corrected. She passed me a sleeveless mail shirt, probably the only one that would fit me. I dumped my leather duster, armored myself, and then put the duster back on over the mail. Murphy shook her head, then she and Thomas collected mail and weaponry of their own. "Couple more things," I said. "Once we're inside, don't eat or drink anything. Don't accept any gifts or any offers from a fairy interested in making a deal. You don't want to wind up owing favors to one of the she, believe you me." I frowned, thinking. Then I took a deep breath and said, "One thing more. Each of us must do everything possible to control our fear." Murphy frowned at me. "What do you mean?" "We can't afford to carry in too much fear with us. The fetches feed on it. It makes them stronger. If we go in there without keeping our fear under control, they'll sense a meal coming. We're all afraid, but we can't let it control our thoughts, actions, or decisions. Try to keep your breathing steady and remain as calm as you can." Murphy nodded, frowning faintly. "All right, then. Everyone hat up and sing out when you're good to go." I watched as Murphy got her gear into place. Charity helped her secure the armor. Her mail was a short-sleeved shirt, maybe one of Charity's spare suits. She'd compensated for the oversized armor by belting it in tight, but the short sleeves fell to her elbows, and the hem reached most of the way to her knees. Murphy looked like a kid dressing up in an adult's clothes. Her expression grew calm and distant as she worked, the way it did when she was focused on shooting, or in the middle of one of her 5,000,000,003 formal katas. I closed my eyes and tentatively pushed my magical senses toward her. I could feel the energy in her, the life pulsing and steady. There were tremors in it, here and there, but there was no screaming beacon of violent terror that would trumpet our approach to the bad guys. Not that I thought there would be. What she lacked in height, she more than made up for in guts. On the other hand, Murphy had never been in the Never-Never. And even though fairy was as normal a place as you can find there,
It could get pretty weird. Despite training, discipline, and determination, novice deep-water divers can never be sure that they will remain free from the onset of the condition called pressure sickness. The never-never was much the same. You can't tell how someone is going to react the first time they fall down the rabbit hole. Thomas, being Thomas, made the male into a fashion statement. He wore black clothing, black combat boots, and the arming jacket and mail somehow managed to go with the rest of his wardrobe. He had his saber on his belt on his left side, carried the shotgun in his right hand, and made the whole ensemble look like an upper-class version of the Road Warrior. I checked on Thomas with my wizard senses, too. His presence had never been fully human, but like the other members of the White Court, the vampiric aspects of him were not obvious to casual observation, not even to wizards. There was something feline about his aura, the same quality I would expect in a hungry leopard waiting patiently for the next meal to approach. Enormous power held in perfect balance. There was a darker portion of him, too, the part I'd always associated with the demonic presence that made him a vampire, a black and bitter well of energy, equal parts lust, hunger, and self-loathing. Thomas was no fool. He was certainly afraid, but the fear couldn't be sensed under that still, black surface. Charity, after she finished helping Murphy, stepped back from her and went to her knees in the parking lot. She folded her hands in her lap, bowed her head, and continued praying. Around her, I felt a kind of ambient warmth, as though she knelt in her own personal sunbeam, the same kind of energy that had always characterized her husband's presence. Faith, I suppose. She was afraid, too, but it wasn't the primitive survival fear the fetches required. Her fear was for her daughter, for her safety, her future, her happiness. And as I watched her, I saw her lips form my name, then Thomas's, then Murphy's. Charity was more afraid for us than herself. Right there, I promised myself that I would get her back home with her daughter, back to her family and her husband, safe and sound and whole. I would not, by God, hesitate for a heartbeat to do whatever was necessary to make my friend's family whole again. I checked myself out, taking inventory. Leather duster, ill-fitting male shirt, staff and blasting rod, check. Shield bracelet and amulet, check. My abused left hand ached a little, and what I could feel of it felt stiff, but I could move my fingers. My head hurt, my limbs felt a little bit shaky with fatigue. I had to hope that adrenaline would kick in and make that problem go away when it counted. "Everyone good to go?" I asked. Murphy nodded. Thomas drawled, "Yep." Charity rose and said, "Ready." "Let me sweep the outside of the building first," I said. "This is their doorway home. It's possible that they've got the place booby-trapped, or that they've set up wards. Once I clear it, we'll go in." I trudged off to walk a slow circle around Pell's theater. I let my fingertips drag along the side of the building, closed my eyes most of the way, and extended my wizard senses into the structure. It wasn't a quick process, but I tried not to dawdle, either. As I walked, I sensed a kind of trapped, suffocated energy bouncing around inside the building. Leakage from the never-never, probably, from when the fetches took Molly across. But several times, I also felt tiny, malevolent surges of energy, too random and mobile to be spells or wards. Their presence was disturbingly similar to that of the fetch I destroyed in the hotel. I came back to where I'd begun about 10 minutes later. "Anything?" Thomas asked. "No wards, no mystic landmines," I told him, "but I think there's something in there."
"Like what?"
"Like fetches," I said. "Smaller than the big ones we're after, and probably set to guard the doorway between here and the never-never."
"They'll try to ambush us when we go in," Murphy said.
"Probably," I said. "But if we know about it, we can turn it against them. When they come, hit them, fast and hard, even if it seems like overkill. We can't afford any injuries."
Murphy nodded.
"What are we waiting for?" Thomas asked.
"More help.
I replied. Why?
Because I'm not strong enough to open a stable passage to Deep Ferry, I said. Even if I wasn't tired and I managed to get it open, I doubt it would stay that way for more than a few seconds.
Which would be bad? Murphy asked.
Yeah.
What would happen? Charity asked quietly.
We'd die, I said. We'd be trapped in Deep Ferry, near the strongholds of all kinds of trouble, with no way to escape but to try to find our way to the portions of Ferry that are near Earth. The locals would eat us and spit out the bones before we got anywhere close to escape.
Thomas rolled his eyes and said,
This isn't exactly helping me keep my mind off my fear, man.
Shut up, I told him, or I'll move to my second initiative and start telling you knock-knock jokes.
Harry, Murphy said, if you knew you couldn't open the door long enough to let us get the girl, how did you plan to manage it?
I know someone who can help. Only she's totally unable to help me.
Murphy scowled at me and then said, You're enjoying this. You just love to dance around questions and spring surprises when you know something the rest of us don't.
It's like heroin for wizards, I confirmed. An engine throbbed nearby, and tires made a susurrus on asphalt. A motorcycle prowled around the theater to its rear parking lot, bearing two helmeted riders. The rearmost rider swung down from the bike, a shapely woman in leather pants and a denim jacket. She reached up, took off her green helmet, and shook out her snow-white hair. It fell at once into a silken sheet without the aid of a brush or a comb. The summer lady, Lily, paused to give me a slight bow, and she smiled at me, her green eyes particularly luminous. The bike's driver proved to be Fix. The summer night wore close-fitting black pants and a billowing shirt of green silk. He bore a rapier with a sturdy guard on his hip, and the leather that wrapped its handle had worn smooth and shiny. Fix put both helmets on a rack on the motorcycle, nodded at us, and said, Good morning. I made introductions, though I went into few details beyond names and titles. When that was done, I told Lily, Thank you for coming. She shook her head. I am yet in your debt. It was the least I could do, though I feel I must warn you that I may not be able to give you the help that you require. Meaning Titania's compulsion to prevent Lily from helping me was still in force, but I'd thought of a way to get around that. I know you can't help me, I said, but I wish to tell you that the onus of your debt to me has been passed to another in good faith. I must redress a wrong I have done to a girl named Molly Carpenter. To do so, I offer her mother your debt to me as payment. Fix barked out a satisfied laugh.
Ha!
Lily's mouth spread into a delighted smile. Well done, wizard, she murmured. She turned to Charity and asked, Do you accept the wizard's offer of payment, lady? Charity looked a little lost, and she glanced at me. I nodded my head at her. Yes, she said. Yes.
So mote it be, Lily said, bowing her head to Charity. Then I owe you a debt, lady. What may I do to repay it?
Charity glanced at me again. I nodded and said, Just tell her. Charity turned back to the summer lady. Help us retrieve my daughter Molly, she said. She is a prisoner of the fetches of the Winter Court.
I will be more than happy to do all in my power to aid you, Lily said.
Charity closed her eyes.
Thank you.
It will not be as much help as you might desire, Lily told her, her voice serious. I dare not directly strike at the servants of Winter, acting in lawful obligation to their queen, except in self-defense. Were I to attack, the consequences could be grave, and retaliation immediate.
Then what can you do? Charity asked.
Lily opened her mouth to answer, but then said,
The wizard seems to have something in mind.
Yep, I said. I was just coming to that.
Lily smiled at me and bowed her head, gesturing for me to continue.
This is where they took the girl across, I told Lily. Must be why they attacked Pell first, to make sure the building was shut down and locked up so that they would have an immediate passage back if they needed it. I'm also fairly sure they left some guardians behind. Lily frowned at me and walked over to the building. She touched it with her fingers and her eyes closed. It took her less than a tenth of the time it had me, and she never moved from the spot.
Indeed, she said.
3 lesser fetches, at least. They cannot sense us yet, but they will know when anyone enters and attack. I'm counting on it, I said. I'm going to go in first and let them see me. Fix lifted his eyebrows. At which point they tear you to bits? This is a craftier plan than I had anticipated. I flashed him a grin. Wouldn't want you to feel left out, Fix. I want Lily to hold a veil over everyone else. Once the fetches show up to rip off my face, Lily drops the veil, and the rest of you drop them.
Yeah, that's a much better plan, Fix drawled, his fingertips tracing over the hilt of his sword.
And I can cut up vassals of Winter, so long as it is no inconvenience to you, of course, milady.
Lily shook her head.
Not at all, Sir Knight. And I will be glad to veil you and your allies, Lady Charity.
Charity paused and said, Wait a minute. Do I understand this situation correctly? You are not allowed to assist Harry, but because Harry has, what, passed his debt to me?
Banks buy and sell mortgages all the time, I said.
Charity arched a brow.
And because he's given me your debt to him, you're doing whatever you can to help?
Fix and Lily exchanged a helpless glance.
They're also under a compulsion that prevents them from directly discussing it with anyone, I filled in. But you've got the basics right, Charity.
Charity shook her head. Aren't they going to be in trouble for this? Who commands her?
Titania, I said.
Charity blinked at me, and I could tell she'd heard the name before.
The Fairy Queen?
One of them, I said. Yeah.
She shook her head.
Enough people are already in danger.
Don't worry about us, ma'am, Fix assured her and winked. Titania has already laid down the law. We've obeyed it. Not our fault if what she decreed was not what she wanted.
Translation, I said. We got around her fair and square. She won't like it, but she'll accept it.
Oh, yeah, Thomas muttered under his breath. This isn't coming back to bite anyone in the ass later.
Ixnay, I growled at him,
and turned and walked toward the theater's rear entrance. I took up my staff in a firm grip and put its tip against the chains, holding the door shut. I took a moment to slow my breathing and focus my thoughts. It wasn't a gross power exercise. I wouldn't have to put nearly as much oomph into shattering the chain if I kept it small, precise, focused. Blasting a door down was a relatively simple exercise for me. What I wanted here was to use a minimum of power to snap a single link in the chain. I brought my thoughts to a pinpoint focus and muttered, Fosari. Power lashed through the length of my staff, and there was a hiss and a sharp crack nearly as loud as a gunshot. The chain jumped. I lowered my staff to find one single link split into 2 pieces, each broken end glowing with heat. I nudged the heated links to the ground with the tip of my staff, faintly surprised and pleased with how little relative effort it had taken. I reached out and tried the doorknob. Locked.
Hey, Murph, I said. Look at that Zeppelin.
I heard her sigh and turn around. I popped a couple of stiff metal tools out of my duster's pocket and started finagling the lock with them. My left hand wasn't much help, but it was at least able to hold the tool steady while my right did most of the work.
Hey, Thomas said. When did you get those?
Butter says it's good for my hand to do physical therapy involving the use of manual dexterity. Thomas snorted.
So you started learning to pick locks? I thought you were playing guitar.
This is simpler, I said, and it doesn't make dogs start howling.
I might have killed you if I'd heard House of the Rising Sun one more time, Thomas agreed.
Where'd you get the picks?
I glanced over my shoulder at Murphy and said,
Little bird.
One of these days, Dresden,
Murphy said, still stubbornly faced away. I got the tumblers lined up and twisted with slow, steady pressure. The deadbolt slid to, and I pulled the door slightly ajar. I rose, put the tools away, and took up my staff again, ready for instant trouble. Nothing happened for a moment. I listened at the door for half a minute, but heard not a sound. All right, I said. Here we go. Everyone ready to... I glanced over my shoulder and found the parking lot entirely empty, except for me. Wow, I said. Good veil, Lily. Then I turned back around, just as if my nerves weren't jangling like guitar strings, and said, Ding, ding. Round one. Chapter 35. I kicked the door open, staff held ready to fight, and shouted, And I'm all out of bubblegum! The pale gray light of the overcast sunrise coming in over the lake showed me a service corridor, the kind with walls that have marks and writing all over them, floors with the paint chipped off all down the middle of the walkway, and lots of stuff stacked up here and there. At the far end of the hallway was a door propped open with a rubber wedge. A worn sign on the door read, Employees Only. A curtained doorway about halfway down the hall opened onto what must have been the concessions counter in the little theater's lobby. Silence reigned. Not a single light shone within. Guess you had to see that one, I said to the empty building. John Carpenter, Rowdy Roddy Piper, longest fight scene ever, you know? Silence. Missed that one, huh? I asked the darkness. I stood there, hoping the bad guys would make this one easy. If they charged me, I could duck aside and then let my concealed allies take them apart. Instead, as bad guys so often do, they failed to oblige me. I started to feel a little silly just standing there. If I went ahead, the narrow passage would negate the participation of those now lurking in veiled ambush behind me. But had I really been alone, the hallway would have been as reasonable a fighting position as I could hope to gain. No way for the fetches to encircle me, no way to use their advantage of numbers. Had I really been alone, I would have needed to jump on an opportunity like that. There are stupid fairies, but fetches aren't among them. If I didn't behave like a lone wolf come to party, it would tip off the presence of my entourage. So, like a crazed loner with more death wish than survival instinct, I boldly strode into the building, staff held ready, teeth bared in a fighting grin. The place was dim and cooler than it should have been, even given the time of day. My breath turned to frost in front of my nose. The movie theater scent of popcorn had sunk into the very foundations and was now as much a part of the building as its walls and floor. My stomach rumbled. Like certain other portions of my anatomy, it had a tendency to become easily sidetracked and to hell with little details like survival. The rest of me was nervous. I had seen how fast one of those creatures could move. I could have ducked out of the way if they'd come charging from the far end of the hall at me, but not by much. Maybe two or three steps in, I reached a point where I judged that I wouldn't have time to retreat and let my allies ambush the attacker. For a few seconds, at least, I'd be on my own. A few seconds are forever in a fight. I shook out my shield bracelet, willed power into it, and walked with my left hand before me, both providing me some protection against a possible charge and casting low blue light that would let me see as I moved forward. Do you know what part of a movie this is? I said to myself as I moved. This is the part where the old farmer with the torch and the shotgun just can't keep himself from walking forward into the dark cave, even though he damn well knows there's a monster in there. I moved up to the hanging curtain and slid it aside with my staff. Several quick glances out showed me a small and dingy concession stand to go along with a small and dingy lobby. Nothing tried to eat my face. Oh, come on, I said louder. I'm starting to feel a little insulted here. If you guys keep this up, I'm going to take drastic cliched measures. Maybe walk backward through a doorway or something. My instinct suddenly screamed, and I flung myself through the curtained doorway, getting clear of the hall, as something darted toward me from the hall's far end. I didn't want to catch any bullets or blasts of fire or hurled hammers from my backup. There was a roar of sound from the hallway,
something letting out a ululating howl, a heavy handgun, a roaring shotgun, and the buzzing snap of an arc of electricity. Blinding, blue-white light blazed through the curtain as I dove through it and showed me the fetch that had lurked in ambush on the other side. It was crouched on top of the glass cabinet, atop the concession stand's popcorn machine, and had taken the form of a creature that could only loosely be called a cat. It was twice Mister's size, and its moldy black fur stood out in tufts and spikes. Its shoulders were hunched, almost deformed with muscle, and its muzzle was broad and filled with teeth too heavy to belong to any feline short of a lion. Its eyes gleamed with a sickly, greenish luminescence, and it flashed through the air, claws extended, teeth bared, emitting a mind-splitting howl of rage. I had no time or space to strike first, and it was a damn good thing I'd prepared my shield ahead of time. I brought it up and into a quarter dome between me and the fetch, blue power hissing. I should have kept in mind how easily the scarecrow had shed my magic the night before. The lesser fetch must have had some measure of the same talent, because it changed the tone of its howl in the middle of its leap, impacted my shield, and oozed through it as though the solid barrier was a thick sludge. There was no space to dodge in and no room to swing my staff, so I dropped it as the fetch's face emerged from my shield and drove my fist into the end of its feline nose. I dropped the shield as I did. With the shield gone, the only force acting on the fetch was the impact of my punch, and the shapeshifter flew backward into the old cash register on the concessions counter. It was made of metal. Blue sparks erupted from the fetch as its flesh hit the iron, along with a yowl of protest, tendrils of smoke, and an acrid odor. I heard footsteps in the corridor behind me, and then a trio of gunshots.
"Harry!"
Murphy called.
"Here!"
I shouted. I didn't have time to say anything else. The nightmare cat bounced up from the cash register, recovered its balance, and flung itself at me again, every bit as swiftly as the fetch I'd faced earlier. I ducked and tried to throw myself under the fetch to get behind it, but my body wasn't operating as swiftly as my mind, and the fetch's claws raked at my eyes. I threw up an arm, and the fetch slammed into it with a sudden, harsh impact that made my arm go numb from the elbow down. Claws and fangs flashed. The spellbound leather of my duster held, and the creature's claws didn't penetrate. Except for a shallow cut, a random claw accidentally inflicted on my wrist below the duster's sleeve, I escaped it unharmed. I hit the ground and rolled, throwing my arm out to one side in an effort to slam the fetch onto the floor and knock it loose. The creature was deceptively strong. It braced one rear leg against the counter, claws digging in, robbing the blow of any real force. It bounced off the floor with rubbery agility, pounced onto my chest, and went for my throat. I got an arm between the fetch and my neck. It couldn't rip its way through the duster, but it was stronger than it had any right to be. I was lying mostly on my back and had no leverage. It wrenched at my arm, and I knew I only had a second or two before it overpowered me, threw my arm out of its way, and tore my throat out. I reached down with my other hand and ripped my duster all the way off the front of my body. Cold iron seared the nightmare cat's paws in a hissing fury of sparks and smoke. The fetch let out another shrieking yowl and bounded almost straight up. Gunshots rang out again as the fetch reached the apogee of its reflexive leap. It twitched and screamed, jerking sharply. As it came back down, it writhed wildly in midair, altering its trajectory, and landed on the floor beside me. Murphy's combat boot lashed out in a stomping kick that sent the fetch sliding across the floor, and the instant it was clear of me, she started shooting again. She put half a dozen shots into the creature, driving it over the floor, howling in pain but thrashing with frenzied strength. The gun went empty. Murphy slammed another clip into the weapon just as the fetch began gathering itself up off the floor. She kept pouring bullets into it as fast as she could accurately shoot and stepped with deliberate care to one side as she did so. Thomas came through the curtain with preternatural speed, his face bone white. He seized the stunned fetch by the throat and slammed it overhand into the cash register again and again until I heard its spine snap.
Then he threw it over the concession stand into the lobby. Light flashed. Something that looked like a butterfly, sculpted from pure fire, shot over my head like a tiny comet. I scrambled to my feet to see the blazing butterfly hit the fetch square in the chest. The thing screamed again, front legs thrashing, rear legs entirely limp, as fire exploded over its flesh, burned a hole in its chest, and then abruptly consumed it whole. I leaned on the counter and panted for a second, then looked around to see the curtain slide aside of its own accord as Lily stepped through it. At that moment, the summer lady did not look sweet or caring. Her lovely face held an implacable, restrained anger, and half a dozen of the fiery butterflies flittered around her. She stared at the dying fetch until the fire winked out, leaving nothing, not even residual ectoplasm behind. Murphy reloaded and came over to me, though her eyes were still scanning for danger. "You're bleeding. You all right?" I checked. Blood from the injury on my wrist had trickled down over my palm and fingers. I pushed back my sleeve to get a look at the wound. The cut ran parallel to my forearm. It wasn't long, but was deeper than I'd thought. And it had missed opening up the veins in my wrist by maybe half an inch. My belly went cold, and I swallowed. "Simple cut," I told Murphy. "Not too bad." "Let me see," Thomas said. He examined the injury and said, "Could have been worse. You'll need a stitch or three, Harry." "No time," I told him. "Help me find something to wrap it up good and tight." Thomas looked around the concessions area and suggested, "Silly straws?" I heard an expressive sigh. Charity appeared at the curtained doorway, flipped open a leather case on her sword belt, and tossed Thomas a compact medical kit. He caught it, gave her a nod, and went to work on my hand. Charity stepped back into the hallway, her expression alert. Fix glanced in and went by the curtained doorway, presumably to the other end of the hall. "What happened?" I asked Murphy. "One of those things charged down the hall to jump on your back," she said. "Looked like some kind of mutant baboon. We took it down." "Nature Red," Thomas mused. "Remember that movie? The one where the retrovirus gets loose in the zoo and starts mutating the animals? Baboon was from there. That cat thing, too." "Huh," I said. "Yeah." "I don't get it," Murphy said. "Why do they all look like movie monsters?" "Fear," I said. "Those images have been part of this culture for a while now. Over time, they've generated a lot of fear." "Come on," Murphy said. "I saw Nature Red. It wasn't that scary." "This is a case of quantity over quality," I said. "Even if it only makes you jump in your chair, there's a little fear. Multiply that by millions. The fetches take the form so that they can tap into a portion of that fear in order to create more of it." Murphy frowned and shook her head. "Whatever." A light appeared in the hallway leading back to the actual theater. In an eye blink, Murphy and Thomas both had their guns pointed at it, and my shield bracelet was dripping heatless blue sparks ready to spring into place. "It's all right," Lily said, her voice low. Fix appeared in the doorway at the far end of the lobby, sword in hand. Fire gleamed along the length of the blade, as if it had been coated in kerosene and ignited. He looked around, frowning, and said, "It isn't back this way." "What isn't?" I asked. "The third," Lily said. "There will be a third fetch." "Why?" I asked. "Because they're fetches," Fix answered. "We should check the bathrooms." "Not alone," I said. "Murph. Charity." Murphy nodded and slipped around the corner to join Fix. Charity slipped through the curtain and to the lobby in her wake. The three of them moved in cautious silence and entered the restrooms. They returned a moment later. Fix shook his head. "There," Thomas said, finishing off the bandage. "Too tight?" I flexed the fingers of my right hand and stooped to recover my staff. "It's good," I squinted around the place. "One room left." We all looked at the double doors leading to the actual theater. They were closed. Faint lights flickered, barely noticeable from within the radius of our own illumination. "If it ain't broke, don't fix it," I said, walking around the counter and into the lobby. I headed for the doors and tried to project confidence.
Same plan.
I paused at the doors while everyone gathered behind me. I looked back to check that they were ready, which is why I was the only one who saw what happened. The plastic trash can, about 6 inches behind Charity, suddenly exploded, the top flipping off, and paper cups and popcorn bags flew everywhere. Something humanoid and no larger than a toddler shot from the trash can. It had red hair and overalls, and it held a big old kitchen knife in one tiny hand. It hit Charity just above her tailbone, driving her into the ground, and lifted the knife. My companions had been taken by surprise, just a second or two, but as far as Charity was concerned, it might as well have been forever. There was no time for thought. Before I realized what I was doing, I took a pair of long steps, shifting my grip on my staff as I went, and swung it like a golf club at the fetch's head. It impacted with a meaty thunk. Its head flew off, bounced off of a pillar, and rolled to a stop not far from the rest of the thing. I had only a second to regard the doll's features before it began dissolving into ectoplasm. Thomas blinked at it and said, "That was Bucky the murder doll." "Kind of a wimp," I said. Thomas nodded. "Must have been the run to the litter." I traded a glance with Murphy. "Personally," I said, "I never understood how anyone could have found that thing frightening to begin with." Then I went to Charity's side and offered her a hand up. She grimaced and took it. "Are you all right?"
"Nothing broken," she replied. She winced and put her hand to her back. "I should have stretched out."
"Next time we'll know better," I said.
"Lily, is that it?"
The summer lady's eyes went distant for a moment, and then she murmured,
"Yes. There are no longer agents of winter in this place. Come."
She stepped forward, and the doors to the theater proper opened of their own accord. We followed. It was your typical movie theater. Not one of the new stadium-seating fancy theaters, but one of the old models, with only a slight incline in the floor. Light played over the screen, though the projector was not running. Spectral colors shifted, faded, changed, and melded like the aurora borealis, and I was struck with a sudden intuition that the color and light were somehow being projected from the opposite side of the screen. The air grew even colder as we followed Lily down the aisle. She stopped in front of the screen, staring blankly at it for a moment, then shuddered.
"Dresden," she said quietly,
"this crossing leads to Arctis Tor." My stomach fluttered again. Oh, crap. I saw Thomas arch an eyebrow at me out of the corner of my eye.
"Crap?" Murphy asked. "Why? What is that place?"
I took a deep breath.
"It's the heart of winter. It's like..." I shook my head. "Think the Tower of London, the Fortress of Solitude, Fort Knox, and Alcatraz, all rolled up into one giant ball of fun. It's Mab's capital, her stronghold." I glanced at Lily. "If what I've read about it is correct, that is. I've never actually seen the place."
"Your sources were accurate enough, Harry," Lily said. Her manner remained remote, strained. "This is going to severely limit what help I can give you."
"Why?" I asked.
Lily stared intently at me for a second, then said,
"My power will react violently to that of Mab. I can open the way to the Arctis Tor, but holding the way open for your return will occupy the whole of my strength. Furthermore, so long as I hold the way open, I run the risk of letting creatures from deep winter run free in Chicago, which means that Fix must remain here to guard the passage against them. I cannot in good conscience send him with you."
I scowled at the shifting colors on the screen.
"So, once we go in, we're on our own."
"Yes."
"Super. Without Lily and Fix's power to counter that of the Winter Fae within Arctis Tor, our odds of success would undergo a steep reduction. And I had hoped we would be attacking an independent trio of fairies, lairing in a cave or under a bridge or something. I hadn't figured on storming the Bastille." I looked up and met Charity's eyes for a second. I turned back to the dancing lights on the movie screen and told the others,
Things just got a lot worse. I'm still going. None of you have to come with me. I don't expect you to. Before I finished speaking, Charity, Murphy, and Thomas stepped up to stand beside me. A bolt of warmth, fierce with joy and pride and gratitude, flashed through me like sudden lightning. I don't care about whose DNA has recombined with whose. When everything goes to hell, the people who stand by you without flinching, they are your family. And they were my heroes. I nodded at Lily. She closed her eyes, and the shimmering colors on the screen grew brighter, more vibrant. The air grew colder. All right, I said quietly. Each of you get a hand on my shoulder. I resettled my grip on my wizard's staff and murmured, Round two. Chapter 36. Every time I opened a way to the Never Never, it always looked pretty much the same. An uneven vertical rip in the air that let in the sights and sounds and scents of the world on the other side. The longer I wanted the rift to stay open, the bigger I'd rip the hole. More experienced wizards had made a comment or two over the years to suggest that I still had a lot to learn on the subject. When Lily opened the way to Arctis Tor, I understood why. Light and color shifted over the screen, their flow quickening, deepening. At first, nothing else happened. The movie screen was simply a surface. Then the hairs on the back of my neck rose, and a cold wind wafted into my face, bringing with it the dry, sterile scent of winter in high, barren mountains and the high, lonely cry of some kind of wild beast like nothing in the real world. Deep blue came to dominate the colors on the screen, and a moment later resolved itself into the shapes of mountains towering beneath the light of an impossibly enormous silver moon. They were bleak and hateful stone peaks, wreathed in mist and wrapped in ice and snow. The wind moaned and blew frozen crystals into our faces, then sank into a temporary lull. The blowing snow cleared just enough to get me my first look at Arctis Tor. Mab's stronghold was a fortress of black ice, an enormous, shadowy cube sitting high up the slope of the highest mountain in sight. A single, elegant spire rose above the rest of the structure. Flickers of green and amethyst energy played within the ice of the walls. I couldn't make a good guess at how big the thing was. The walls and battlements were lined with inverted icicles. They made me think of the fanged jaws of a hungry predator. A single gate, small in comparison to the rest of the fortress, stood open. Hell's bells. How the hell was I supposed to get in there? It was almost a relief when the wind rose again, and blowing snow once more obscured the fortress from view. It was only then that I realized that the way was open. Lily had brought it forth so smoothly that I hadn't been able to tell when image gave way to reality. By comparison, my own ability to open a way to the Never Never was about as advanced as the paintings of a particularly gifted gorilla. I glanced back at Lily. She gave me a small smile and then gestured with one hand. One of the fiery butterflies fluttering around her altered course and soared over to me. "This much I can do for you all," she murmured. "It will lead you through the storm and ward away the cold until you can return here. Do not tarry, wizard. I do not know how long I will be able to hold the way open for your return." I nodded. "Thank you, Lily." This time her smile was warmer, more like that of the girl she had been before becoming the summer lady. "Good luck, Harry." Fix took a deep breath and then hopped up onto the stage floor at the base of the movie screen. He turned to offer me a hand up. I took it, stared at the frozen wasteland for a second, and then stepped directly forward into what had been the screen. I found myself standing in knee-deep snow, and the howling winds forced my eyes almost shut. I should have been freezing, but whatever enchantment Lily's blazing butterfly used seemed effective. The air felt almost as warm as that of a ski slope seeing its last day of the season.
Thomas, Murphy, and Charity stepped out of a shimmer in the air, and Fix followed them a second later.
"Hey, Fix," I said.
I had to raise my voice to be heard over the wind.
"I thought you weren't coming."
A summer night shook his head.
"I'm not, but it will be easier to stop anything going through from this side," he said.
He regarded us and asked lightly,
"You bring enough iron, you think?" "We're about to find out." "Christ, you're going to piss off Mab something fierce bringing iron here." "I was doing that anyway," I assured him.
He nodded, then glanced back at the rift and frowned.
"Harry," he said, "there's something you should know before you go in."
I arched an eyebrow and listened.
"We just got word from our observers that there's a battle underway. The Reds found one of the major headquarters of the Venatori Umbrorum."
"Who?" Charity asked.
"Secret organization," I told her. "Like the Masons, but with machine guns." "The Venatori sent out a call for help," Fix continued. "The Council answered it."
I chewed my lower lip.
"Do you know where?" "Oregon, a couple hours from Seattle," he said. "How bad is it?" "So far, it's too close to call, but it's not good. The Reds had their sorceress types mucking around with a lot of the Council's pathways through the Never Never. A lot of the Wardens got sidetracked from the battle completely."
"Damn it," I muttered. "Isn't there anything Summer can do to help?" Fix grimaced and shook his head.
"Not with the way Mab's forces are disposed. If we pull enough of our forces from Summer to help the Council, it will weaken us. Winter will attack."
He stared at the looming fortress, glimpsed in half instants through the gusting snow, and shook his head.
"The Council's mindset is too defensive, Harry. If they keep sitting tight and reacting to the enemy, instead of making the Reds react to them, they'll lose this war."
I grunted.
"Clausewitz would agree, but I don't think the Merlin knows from Clausewitz, and this is a long way from over. Don't count us out yet." "Maybe," he said, but his voice wasn't confident. "I wish I could do more, but you'd better get going. I'll hold the door for you."
I offered him my hand, and he shook it.
"Be careful," I said.
"Good hunting," he replied. I glanced at my three companions and called.
"Ready?"
They were. We followed the burning butterfly through the snow. Without its protection from the elements, I doubt we would have made it, and I made it a point to remember to wear sufficient cold weather gear in the event that I somehow survived this ongoing idiocy and was crazy enough to come back a second time. Even with the summer magic to protect us, it was a pretty good hike over unfriendly terrain. I'd done worse in the past, with both Justin DeMorn and Ebenezer, and there are times when having long legs can be a real advantage on rough terrain. Charity seemed all right, too, but Thomas had never been much of an outdoorsman, and Murphy's height put her at a disadvantage that the unaccustomed weight of her armor and cutlery exacerbated. I traded a glance with Charity. I started giving Thomas a hand on rough portions of our climb. Charity helped Murphy. At first I thought Murphy might take her arm off out of wounded pride, but she grimaced and visibly forced herself to accept the help. The last 200 yards or so were completely open, with no trees or undulation of terrain to shield our approach from the walls of the fortress. I lifted a hand to call a halt at the edge of the last hummock of stone that would shelter us from view. Lily's butterfly drifted in erratic circles around my head, snowflakes hissing to steam where they touched it. I peered over the edge of a frozen boulder at Arctis Tor for a long time, then settled back down again. "I don't see anyone," I said, trying to keep my voice down.
"Doesn't make any sense," Thomas said.
He was panting and shivering a little, despite Lily's warding magic.
"I thought this was supposed to be Mab's headquarters. This place looks deserted."
"It makes perfect sense," I said. "Winter's forces are all poised to hit Summer. You don't do that from the heart of your own territory. You gather at strong points near the enemy's border. If we're lucky, maybe there's just a skeleton garrison here."
Murphy peered around the edge of the stones and said, "The gate's open. I don't see any guards." She frowned. There's something on the open ground between here and there. See?" I leaned next to her and peered. Vague, shadowy shapes stirred in the wind between us and the fortress, insubstantial as any shadow. Oh, I said. It's a glamour, illusion laid out around the place, probably a hedge maze of some kind.
And it fools people? She asked uncertainly.
It fools people who don't have groovy wizard ointment for their eyes, I said.
Then I frowned and said, wait a minute. The gate isn't open. It's gone.
What? Charity asked.
She leaned out and stared.
There is a broken lattice of ice on the ground around the gate. A portcullis?
Could be, I agreed. And inside, I squinted, I think I can see some heavier pieces. Like maybe someone ripped apart the portcullis and blew the gate in.
I took a deep breath, feeling a hysterical little giggle lurking in my throat.
Something huffed and puffed and blew the house in. Mab's house.
The wind howled over the frozen mountains.
Well, Thomas said, that can't be good.
Charity bit her lip.
Molly.
I thought you said this Mab was almighty and stuff, Harry, Murphy said.
She is, I said, frowning.
Then who plays big bad wolf to her little pig?
I shook my head and rubbed at my mouth. I'm starting to think that maybe I'm getting a little bit out of my depth here.
Thomas broke out into a rippling chuckle, a faint note of hysteria to it. He turned his back to the fortress and sat down, chortling. I glowered at him and said, it's not funny.
It is from here, Thomas said. I mean, God, you are dense sometimes. Are you just now noticing this, Harry?
I glowered at him some more.
To answer your question, Murph, I don't know who did this, but the list of people who could is fairly short. Maybe the senior council could if they had the wardens along, but they're busy, and they'd have had to fight a campaign to get this far. Maybe the vampires could have done it, working together, but that doesn't track. I don't know. Maybe Mab pissed off a god or something.
There is only one god, Charity said. I waved a hand and said,
no capital G, Charity, in deference to your beliefs. But there are beings who aren't the Almighty, who have power way beyond anything running around the planet.
Like who? Murphy asked.
Old Greek and Roman and Norse deities. Lots and lots of Amerind divinity and African tribal beings. A few Australian aboriginal gods. Others in Polynesia, Southeast Asia. About a zillion Hindu gods. But they've all been dormant for centuries.
I frowned at Arctis Tor.
And I can't think what Mab might have done to earn their enmity. She's avoided doing that for thousands of years.
Unless, of course, I thought to myself, Mav and Lily are right, and she really has gone bonkers.
Dresden, Charity said, this is academic. We either go in or we leave. Now.
I chewed my lip and nodded. Then I dug in my pockets for the tiny vial of blood Charity had provided and hunted through the rocks until I found a spot clear enough to chalk out a circle. I empowered it and wrought one of my usual tracking spells, keying it to a sensation of warmth against my senses. Cold as it was, I would hardly mind anything that might make me feel a little less freeze-dried. I broke the circle and released the spell, and immediately felt a tingling warmth on my left cheekbone. I turned to face it and found myself staring directly at Arctis Tor. I paced 50 or 60 yards to the side and faced the warmth again, working out a rough triangulation.
She's alive, I told Charity, or the spell wouldn't have worked. She's in there. Let's go.
Wait, Charity said. She gave me a look filled with discomfort and then said, may I say a brief prayer for us first?
Can't hurt, I said. I'll take all the help I can get.
She bowed her head and said, Lord of hosts, please stand with us against this darkness. The quiet, bedrock-deep energy of true faith brushed against me. Charity crossed herself. Amen. Murphy echoed the gesture and the amen. Thomas and I tried to look theologically invisible. Then, without further speech, I swung out around the frozen stone cairn and broke into a quick, steady jog. The others followed along. I passed the first bones 50 yards from the walls. They lay in a crushed, twisted jumble in the snow, frozen into something that looked like a macabre Escher print. The bones were vaguely human, but I couldn't be sure because they'd been pulverized to dust in some places, warped like melted wax in others. It was the first grisly memorial of many. As I kept going forward, brittle, frozen bones crunched under my boots, lying closer and thicker and twisted more horribly as we drew closer to Arctis Tor. By the time we got to the gate, I was shin-deep in icy bones. They spread out on either side in an enormous wheel of horrible remains centered on the gate. Whoever they had been, thousands of their kind had perished here. Charity's guess about the portcullis had been bang on. Pieces of it lay scattered about, mixed among the bones. Where the gate arched beneath the fortress walls, there were still more bones, waist-deep on me, and slabs of plain dark ice, the remains of the fortress gate, stuck out at odd angles. The walls of Arctis Tor had been pitted with what I could only assume had been an acid of some kind. There were larger gouges blown out of the walls here and there, but against their monolithic volume, they were little more than pockmarks. I pushed ahead to the gate, plowing my way through the bones. Once there, I caught a faint whiff of something familiar. I leaned closer to one of the craters blown out of the wall and sniffed.
"What is it?" Thomas asked me.
"Sulfur," I said quietly. "Brimstone."
"What does that mean?" he asked.
"No way to tell," I half lied, but my intuition was absolutely certain of what had happened here. Someone had thrown hellfire against the walls of Arctis Tor, which meant that the forces of the literal hell, or their agents, were also playing a part in the ongoing events. Way, way, way out of my depth. I told myself that it didn't matter. There was a young woman inside that frozen boneyard who would die if I did not burgle her out of this nightmare. If I did not control my fear, there was an excellent chance that it would warn her captors of my approach. So I fought the fear that threatened to make me start throwing up or something equally humiliating and potentially fatal. I readied my shield, gripped my staff, ground my teeth together, and then continued pushing my way forward, through the bones and into the eerie dimness of the most ridiculously dangerous place I had ever been. Chapter 37. The black ice walls of Arctis Tor were 60 feet thick, and walking through the gateway felt more like walking through a railroad tunnel, except for all the bones. Every breath, every step, every rasp